And there's disaster management ideas, which are far superior to what we have. So, just to say
yeah,
that.
But we can't say we're going to share it. They must say so.
Exactly.
We can say we'd share ours.
Yeah.
But we can't say others must share it. They must say so.
Well, it could be good in the white paper to say we must learn. And then on the back of the page, printed on the back to save paper, I've just been, and this is just for information and to end up with, off with, is climate change is basically about adapting to things that are coming and trying to prevent damage into the future. And part of that is to do that in a way that we create more jobs, we don't lose jobs, and that we improve the quality of life of people. So I, together with some colleagues, have been playing with numbers in an attempt to see how quickly we could drop the carbon budget or drop our emissions. And whether the government's peak plateau decline trajectory is reasonable, ambitious, or basically not much use. So the green line, if I just take you through it, so obviously the years are along the bottom axis. The vertical axis has got tons of carbon, or million tons of carbon, and the different lines represent different things. So the green line at the top is the peak plateau decline government path, as proposed in the paper that they produced, the discussion paper. I had the slide is up there, but I didn't bother to print it. The purple line is the low peak plateau decline trajectory. And the light blue, which does a very steep kind of curve down, that is what you, I'm sure, have heard from other organizations, a kind of what is called an equitable target. In other words, because South Africa has historically emitted a lot, we should reduce our emissions much faster and further in order to allow...
That's not a serious suggestion, that is. This is an issue of faith. It's a leap of faith.
Yeah,
to go from 500 to naught, it's something we can't take too seriously. We can pray for it, but we can't do more, surely.
Miracles do happen. But just to continue, that line is kind of the idealistic hard to get to. And yes, it's not something that we really got on the negotiation table, but I'm putting it out there as if we were going to be the world's ideal leader and we want to be visionary, that would be the kind of path we'd have to follow. But as the chair has pointed out, that's almost a physical, what is a physical impossibility. So what the dark blue line is the amount of emissions that the electricity sector is responsible for, kind of on the peak plateau decline, so with a bit of an adjustment. And then the red line is what if we were to try and shift a few things around. And the reason I wanted to share this with you is one of those shifting things is to potentially delay Kusile, and really bring in some strong energy efficiency, just flatten things a bit. But the other issue is to move transport, to shift 10% of current road transport off the road, which is not very much, 10%, but it's public transport, you can create jobs, and to just bring in a bit of efficiency. And we've looked at about 15 to 19% reduction due to efficiency, but over a 10-year period. And then you get something like the red line. So the conclusion is that we can do better than the low path of that the government's put forward. But it does.
Why do those two lines start under 300?
Because
whereas the 15, everyone knows that the 2010 that figure down by only looking at the electricity sector, doesn't it?
Because
make
the electricity sector is a
very. No, it's the main one, but I mean, you can't then in your graph you can't leave out the rest.
No,
I can understand that you can show a steep decline by saying it would go straight for electricity, but I mean you can't ignore the others.
No.
They must be there, and then the graph will look differently.
It's an illustration of what we can potentially do, simply to demonstrate that we could do better than the current government.
Let me ask you the question. I mean, I don't have the picture up there that I wanted to show you, but the picture that the it's very clear that the trajectory we have.
Yeah.
And it's explained on the website of the department. Is that in the last 13 years, from 97, when we did the LTMS, to 2010, we increased with 149 megatons, almost 150.
Mm-hmm.
In 13 years, we increased from about a 400, so it's 550. In the next 15 years, the government's trajectory is only allowing for an increase of 67 megatons. In 15 years, we have committed ourselves to half of what we've increased in the last 13 years. Now, I ask you quite seriously, and I really have asked anyone this, and I haven't had a single answer from anyone, except everyone says we want to be more ambitious and quicker. I'm asking us, how are we even going to achieve the target government has?
Well, I think
to decrease the last, when we've increased our economy quite tremendously in the last, where we now have emitted our 150, and we now say we want to only in the next 15, only emit 67 megatons. Cut the last 15 years increase, we want to cut in half. How are people coming to say that this is not ambitious?
It fails me.
The logic of it fails me. I can understand that NGOs and so on want a quicker movement, and that's great, and the quicker we go, the better. But how logically and intellectually are we saying that this is not ambitious? I mean, I think it can't be achieved, but I mean, you know.
Well, I think the rationale that it should be maybe more ambitious is because I do think it's feasible to do more. If you focus on efficiency in the short term and you ramp up your renewables so that you're not simply building coal, that's where we're getting stuck. So,
but you can't say we mustn't build coal. You can't say we must mothball Kusile, because our whole economy growth and where we're going to get energy from in this period is from there. What we need to do is, it's very clear that we have to ramp up other energy sources parallel to that, and that is 17,000 megawatts being agreed to, which was hugely increased from last time. Now, we can debate whether that's enough. I mean, we can debate that till the cows come home. But the issue I'm just asking, you know, for us to take people seriously, I mean, and when they come and say that we have committed ourselves in the next 15 years to emit no more than 67 megatons more than we're doing now in 15 years. How on earth are we going to say that we want to decrease even that?
Well, all I'm saying is that we could do better than that and at the same time shift our economy slightly. I don't even want to go to the point of saying that we are a low emitter internationally and therefore we sort of have space to do what, to expand our emissions. I don't think that's a good way, development path for the country. So what I'm saying is we've got Medupi, we're building Kusile, but if we can peak and decline and not plateau and decline rather than peaking,
I'm asking Ms. McDaddy, you see, the issue is a simple one, and I think you guys must go and look at it, the NGOs particularly, that's saying we must be more ambitious. I'm asking, if we just cut away a whole lot of stuff, I mean, I don't even know how we're going to, we cut out, How are we going to only grow in the next 15 years with only 67 megatons? That's the issue. To say that, yes, no, we can easily go lower, we can't, because, I mean, how on, just logically, how do you increase the growth that you're going to decrease it by half?
Because
you and say you can go faster than that. I mean, just how do you do that?
Okay, my view would be that our economic growth needs to shift, and it is doing that, de-link from our emissions trajectory. So that they are not the same thing. In other words, you then are not growing the economy only if you grow your emissions. You're growing the economy, but you are keeping your emissions stable and hopefully decreasing them. And I mean, I think there's a lot of work that's been done on how to do that. So you reduce your energy intensity. Your industry just works more efficiently. You shift people off this addiction to petrol onto public transport. That's good for the country. It's a good development. But it's not, you're then de-linking that from emissions.
All that is built into the plan as it stands now, and what we have said is that we can only grow half of what we grow the emissions half what we did in the last 13 years with this new trajectory path that we already have, which does include all the things that we're saying, 17,000 megawatts of renewables, moving to from freight to rail, moving to public transport, all that's built into it. Creating carbon tax. The main thing in this paper is to seriously, for the first time, price carbon. Those things are all being done. All I'm saying is that, you know, if the NGOs want to come and suggest, and some of them are reasonable about it, like yourselves, well, you're not an NGO specifically, but, well, I think you've got a more direct line than NGOs to on whose behalf you speak, so I don't think NGOs have got that, but you know, but what I'm just saying is for us to seriously debate the issue of being more ambitious. I mean, we must seriously look at what we said. As I say, I mean, I'm still waiting for next year. I want the government to come explain to me how we're going to achieve that. I'm fully supportive of that trajectory. I have no doubt, of course, this committee was pushed it so that it's in this paper, that it's there now, on there. So we're very... But, you know, I think we must... But let me leave it there. I think that there's some thinking has to go into this. Any other issues you want to raise?
No, that's... well, basically, that was the
end
point.
That's
to say we need to de-link that economy. And I think also the other issue is to focus on adaptation as a developmental path for the country. We tend to see it as just like, you know, shame for people. We have to, like, give them handouts. But there's actually a developmental path in shifting your economy towards adaptation, one that's climate resilient.
Well, I think the paper's doing that now.
Yeah.
I think the problem is going to be how we do it in practice. I mean, that's more difficult, because if the rest of the world's not doing it, or most of the rest of the world, how do we do it, and then so on. But okay, I think that's another debate. All right, members, that is an input, some interesting points. Can we have some questions, if there are? Seems, is everyone happy? Do you have faith in this input? Mr. Skozana?
Yeah, Chairman. Start by saying, I mean, Chairperson, I should think we must thank the presentation from Faith and also indicate that climate change is for everybody in the country, because it's affecting everybody in the country. Now, on water supply allocation, I just want to hear the involvement of Faith in assisting us to conserve water in the country, particularly in the area where they stay, because one of the fundamental issues that is part of climate change, I should think, is water, the shortage of water. Once we have a shortage of water, then we've got a problem. And the country, as I'm talking, saving a shortage of water, there is no rain, no crops that are growing now, because there is no rain. I just want to hear your role there. And also,
why don't you suggest that maybe they should pray more every Sunday?
Yes. Chair. And Chair, I must say again, the capacity of government to deliver. I should think the government is in the right position to deliver whatever is necessary to be delivered by the government. Even this climate change, we must deliver it, we like it or not. The only issue, it can be the shortage of resources. We have sufficient resources, which means we must start from there in mobilizing resources in order to deliver our resources. Thank you.
Mr. Tsetse.
On the time frame as well, one of the things of the unforeseen with the conferences that might create some stumbling block for the government to reach the time frame, because this is not a national issue, but it's a national global issue, whereby other stakeholders, participating in that time frame, the slow pace, and those are some of the challenges. And the slider talks about Mozambique, even if you say you're not going to talk to it, it's just for the members' interest. I see it as very crucial, something to advocate or make noise on it. It's very important that we have this warning sign to minimize the damage and save lives. And encouraging people to use public transport is also, something that we should do on a daily basis to encourage people, but also consider the fact that the efficiency of public transport, you have how train, which you can say is effective, but how many of us could afford how train? But it's quite a good presentation. And the site is very revolutionary, it says adapt or die. We'll try to adapt.
Any other questions? No. Adapt or die, Mr. Foster. No, it was P. W. Buerta.
Yeah.
I won't comment on the praying for rain, but in terms of the. Maybe the members would like to join the Deputy President at the Faith Rally on the 27th of November in Durban, which is a faith gathering to call on the international community to do the right thing or do the moral thing in terms of going forward around climate change, to sort of try and set the tone for the international negotiations. So I think, just to reflect on some of this, in terms of water conservation, firstly to say from a faith perspective, SASE has a program called Eco Congregations, which is about local faith communities becoming climate friendly or environmentally friendly, and things like water tanks and stuff like that, very practical. In terms of water scarcity in the country, we often see things like, well, we need water for water supply for industry or for agriculture, therefore we must build dams, as if building dams automatically means there's water to fill them. And I think, as a member has rightly pointed out, that the predictions for the country are that, particularly in the west of the country, there won't be any rain to fill those dams. Evaporation will be higher. And in the second place, where in areas where there's going to be more rain, it's going to be more intense, more runoff, and that water won't stick around. It will cause enormous erosion, which will tilt up your dam. So I think we have to look at, a few years ago there was talk about using aquifers, underground aquifers, and kind of recharging them and storing water there because it doesn't evaporate. So for me, the white paper talks to the Department of Water Affairs, I think it's called the Growth Water for Growth Strategy, and I think one just needs to be cautious that it's appropriate infrastructure, closed pipelines, not open canals, you know, simple things like that, but that actually can make quite a huge difference to water. No more spraying water madly over the irrigation fields. It should all be drip irrigation. And I can give you a case study of the West Coast where there was a drought where the guys managed to increase the amount of crops under cultivation with, I think it was 40% less water because there was a drought. So it can be done, and we just need to fast-track that. In terms of finances, I remember Matt, well, has obviously realized the concern and going forward. Is I discovered the other day from one of the official negotiators that in simple terms, or they had to make it simple to me, the finance regime being put forward at the moment is that rich countries will potentially get finance to pay them not to pollute, and poor countries will have to borrow money in order to adapt. Seems to be radically inequitable to me, but that is one of the aspects being discussed in Durban. I think also the issue to finance is, I think, Chairperson, you've raised this before in earlier meetings, is that South Africa has got resources. We need to shift our allocation. We need to restructure how our government aligns. There's no good building a dam, putting a lot of money in, and then it gets tilted up. It's just a waste of money. So for me, the critical part of this white paper to make it work is that a very short-term thing is to review where our current infrastructure build is going and see if it really is going to benefit us in 10 years' time, or is it going to be stranded assets. I think I'll just leave it there. I hope I've covered everything. Thank you.
No, we'll take the leap of faith. And
I shall see you on the 27th.
I'm tied up, sorry. I'd love to, but I've got my own difficulties in life. Thank you very much, Ms. McDaid. I appreciate it. I thought that the presentation was a clever one in the sense of raising the different issues. But as I said, I think really people, and I know you haven't had a lot of time, so I'm not suggesting that you should have done it, but I really think we should look at this thing of more ambitious. I mean, because the problem I have is I don't want this policy or this plan to be discredited because we're too ambitious. As I say, you know, I still want to hear from government, and we gave some input here last time, and I can see with the white paper changing completely with carbon pricing, how are we hoping to only increase our carbon emissions with half what we did the previous 15 years. I can see why we're hoping that can happen. But if you just think about it, even as we sit there, that plan says 2010, we're now 2011, we're already giving ourselves 2 years to set the carbon pricing in place, which makes it 2013. So it means you really actually don't have 15 years in which to only increase by half. It then becomes 12 years that you have to then decrease and come to half of it. So I'm just saying, you know, no one of us can benefit by, and particularly in a world where people are not prepared to do what we're doing, that we set ourselves our own carbon limits and that we're going to achieve it. And so that's what I'm saying, you know. It makes much more, I must say to you, as a policymaker, if people come here with us and say things honestly and not just, as I say, I understand why we want to let it go quicker. But if it can't go quicker, physically, we've all waited, the world has waited too long. And now we found ourselves in a difficulty. And now we're saying, well, all those plans we had in the last 15 years while we were negotiating, we now have to compress it into the same period of time we said previously. And by that, we're trying to then create ambitions we can't achieve. Then it's not going to help us out. That doesn't mean that the things that you're saying where we can try and move faster, you know, I mean, clearly those, we can move faster, we must move faster, and government moving too slow and so on. But it's in that context where I'm saying we must intellectually be more rigorous in terms of what we can do. Because it's much better to hold the government to account to what they can do than try and set limits that we know offhand that they can't achieve. And then, you know, later on we want to all bitch and moan and whine and so on. It's much easier, and it's much easier for us as policymakers that we can then follow it and every year call them and see how things are happening. I mean, if we start setting it at a bar, which we clearly know is not going to work, we're all going to get frustrated in the process. And then the implementers are going to get frustrated. So that's the kind of things that worry me. I mean, you know, we've now been, or most of us that are sitting in this room, all of us in this room from in Parliament, weren't part of previous parliaments and so on. So our experience that we've gained of how government works or doesn't work has happened in the last whatever many years at least we've been here. And I think we all, even, I mean, whether you're in the ruling party or the opposition, we all know that there are really, really realistic constraints to how government can operate and can't operate. So to try and that's all I'm trying to say, is that let's be rigorous, let's be ambitious as possible, but let's not go overboard. Because if we go overboard, and it's got nothing to do with what you guys are saying, that we, I mean, someone said yesterday that Sasol and Eskom negotiate directly in the climate negotiations. Now, you know, and these are not foolish people that are saying this, but you know, to try and create that impression that, you know, I mean, this is all about trying to protect business. I mean, nothing can be further. I mean, you know, even if you look at that plan that's there, to say we're only going to allow increase of emissions by half what we did the previous 15 years. I mean, how could anyone say that this is all pro-business? I mean, I agree that business are making some stupid statements. I mean, Cecil's input here was atrocious. It was absolutely atrocious. I mean, I couldn't believe what the things that they were saying. And it's someone, you know, that, well, let me not be ugly. That's all I wanted to say. So I want us to try and put this debate on a more even keel and balance. And there's no problem that NGOs want to bend the stick that way, and there's no problem that business is going to want to now come and tell us to bend it this way. I mean, obviously we'll come to our own conclusions, but I'm just thinking that if every NGO comes here and says this must be more ambitious, I'm wondering to what extent we're actually engaging with the real issues. And the real issue for me here is what can government produce in this time? Not what is the ideal in the world, but what can government actually be able to implement and make this thing work. And I think there's too little of the debate there, which doesn't mean we must only have the debate on the basis of how weak government is.
Yeah.
What the problem then is that we see to what extent we can get government to be more effective in what they're doing and so on. I mean, you know, those are all logical things. And the debate's going to only be meaningful if we're actually talking relatively close to each other. If we're talking like you on the moon and you on the sun, and businesses on Venus, you know, those things just don't work.
May I just say that in terms of ambition, I think firstly I wanted to say that I think this particular graph and the idea of the low peak plateau decline is a serious commitment by government. But I also think that one also needs to look a little bit and say, you know, you can reach as far as you can stretch. So if you only stretch a little bit, you'll only reach there. So it's the role of NGOs to kind of push things a bit. But I also think one needs to maybe think a little bit. I can imagine that this kind of debate is happening in the kind of parliaments of the US and in Europe, where they're saying, you know, well, our economy, we can't do this, and we can't actually commit. And the reality outside of what we're all discussing in good faith is that people are actually going to die, and you know, people are going to suffer massively the longer it takes us to actually do this. So I think maybe that's my appeal, is that practical ambitions, but maybe not too much pragmatism. Thank you.
No, I agree. You see, the problem is people are going to die in any case because the world's not coming to an agreement.
Yeah.
So by South Africa doing something on its own, I mean, it's like, there's an ugly saying, but it's like wooing against the Krabi Falls, you know. There's no comparison, you can't do it. So I think those are the issues that we have to look at, be realistic. If government wants to set something and no one else is setting, then we should try and accommodate it in a balanced and reasonable way. I think that's the ultimate. But let's leave it at that. I think you've made your point very clearly.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Now we have the, I think it's the Premier's office in the Western Cape. It's submission number 35. And the person involved is Miss Helen Davies. Helen Davies, there you are, Miss Davies. Good morning. Thank you for taking the effort to be here. You're the only province that have done so, so it's very nice to at least get some response, also from government's capacities. Our process is that you give your input 10 to 15 minutes and then we'll engage. Okay? Thank you. Good morning. There's no slide presentation. We'll just speak from the document. It's number 35. 35.
Thank you very much and good morning, everyone. From our side, first of all to say I'm from Department of Environmental Affairs and Development Planning, but the comment that's been put together is from a number of departments across the provincial government of the Western Cape. At the outset, we'd like to say that we think the White Paper is a very visionary document, and that if implemented successfully, will set South Africa on the path to addressing climate change in a meaningful manner, both in terms of reducing the country's contribution to greenhouse gases, and also in terms of strengthening the resilience of the country to handle the impacts of climate change. The proposed means of undertaking the objectives of the White Paper will, however, require significant expertise and funding at scale. And a lot of our comment is based very much on the implementation of the White Paper. Of concern is that the strategy might be too ambitious in what can be achieved in the short term. So while we recognize what's just been said now in terms of targets, in terms of what capacity and funding is available at the moment, there is a concern. Despite the White Paper's proposal to provide to build capacity for provincial and local governments' climate change response strategies, it is felt that these are unlikely to adequately address the serious capacity problems that we're experiencing at local and provincial governments. As a result, a number of the responses required of provincial and local governments might be difficult, if not possible, to achieve, impossible to achieve. Further prioritisation and potential phasing in of the elements of the strategy should be considered to take account of the existing capacity and funding constraints, with the ability to roll out further elements of the strategy being realised as capacity and funding becomes increasingly available. In addition, the White Paper doesn't necessarily address trade-offs between the large number of strategic objectives and priorities laid out in the document. And without this, the White Paper may present an unrealistic expectation of what can be achieved within the tight timeframe. With regards to the responses required by the private sector, it needs to be noted that in the Western Cape, based business is dominated primarily by medium and small enterprises, which would be hard-pressed to comply or assume the costs. As such, there's a call for a differentiated response for large, medium, and small businesses to avoid unintentional negative impacts on investment and job creation. Clarity is also sought on whether the review of all policies, strategies, legislation, regulations, plans include those at the provincial and municipal level. And if they do, there's a request or a call for capacity support to undertake the review of your regulatory measures at these spheres of government. It's very encouraging to see the intended efforts to secure financial assistance for climate change-related response actions. It is, however, requested that the process to access these funds be designed in a manner that minimises the time and capacity spent on accessing the funds so that more time can be spent on actually using the funds. And concern is raised that the time frame for the work around resource mobilisation is too long, given that the implementation at scale of climate change-related projects requires financing now, requires immediate financing. On some of the more specific comments, it is noted that the special needs and circumstances of vulnerable groups to the adverse effects of climate change is considered in the White Paper, but it suggested that a further understanding of not only the direct impacts of climate change, but also the indirect and socio-economic impacts of climate change on these grounds be considered. And interaction with relevant civil society groups will need to be undertaken to understand the needs and requirements of these sectors. On the adaptation front, it is noted that the white paper does not provide any targets relating to adaptation projects, and it's recommended that measurable actions be put in place for this area of focus. So one such target could relate to the number of municipalities that include the development and implementation of adaptation plans in their IDPs. Once again, that's going to require capacity and funding support. Clarity is requested on the timeframes for developing sectoral plans, undertaking risk analyses of these plans, and identifying and implementing initiatives to address the sectoral plan. The focus of adaptation responses on the local level will result in a high demand on provincial and local governments to manage complex responses within and across sectors. And the ability for this to be undertaken, once again, is going to be undermined by serious capacity constraints at these levels of government, which needs to be addressed in the white paper. While plantations might be regarded as potential carbon sinks, this needs to be compared against the sequestration capability of indigenous vegetation, which at the same time increases stream flow and promotes biodiversity. And any plans for agriculture to extend into new areas should consider the consequent potential impacts on biodiversity. It's suggested that the response to the challenges of human and urban settlements should include improving energy and water and resource efficiency and decreasing waste production through technology and behavior change, in order to decrease the footprint of settlements and enable urban settlements to operate or survive with less resources. The impact of climate change on coastal communities, particularly those dependent on subsistence fishing, should also be highlighted and discussed in greater detail, as this has a significant socioeconomic impact on communities. On the mitigation front, it is noted that desired emission reduction outcomes will be defined for each significant sector and subsector of the economy. Once this is done on a national level, the question is whether support will be provided to translate these reduction outcomes to a provincial level, given the differences in sectoral focuses in the different provinces. The question is raised as to whether it would be possible for desired emission reduction sectoral outcomes to be undertaken in a shorter time frame than the 2 years proposed. Provinces need to decide on interim measures in the short term, but these need to be in alignment with national. So we raise a call here for joint working and early clarity on national outcomes to help in this regard. Concern is raised on mitigation activities in the transport and energy sector, and that they could result in increased prices that might significantly affect poor communities who already spend significant proportions of their income on these sectors. And a call is made for the impact on poor communities to be considered or minimized. It is assumed that industry or sector bodies would drive the majority of the proposed mitigation activities. Is this due to be legislated to ensure compliance? And in addition, should the white paper not identify the principles that will be applied in determining which companies or entities will be required to meet desired emissions reduction outcomes? Without this clarity, there may be significant business uncertainty with regards to policy obligations and potential compliance measures. The white paper notes that companies in economic sectors will be required to submit detailed mitigation plans. This requirement will have cost implications on the economy and will require additional capacity within government to evaluate and monitor such plans. And the question again comes whether that will be done at a national level or devolved to other spheres of government. On the issue of greenhouse gas inventories, it must be noted that a number of local and provincial government inventory exercises have been undertaken to support the development of relevant strategies and targets. And these processes should feed into and support the national process and vice versa. It's also suggested that the data be disaggregated by region, sector and fuel type in order to support the development of strategies and plans at a provincial and local level. Moving on to near-term priority flagship programs. Excuse me. Clarity is sought on whether the idea of the flagship program...
Yes, 7 minutes left.
Thank you. Is the idea for the flagship programs to be scaled up, rolled out over new areas, and supported with additional funding? Will government bodies be able to tap into the proposed climate financing if their projects are aligned with flagship programs? Clarity is also sought on whether the proposal in the white paper for enhancing domestic, manufacturing potential of renewable energy and implementation of energy efficiency and renewable energy plans by local government will be accompanied by support to undertake this responsibility. It must be noted that enhancing domestic manufacturing potential might be best placed at the provincial level to benefit from economies of scale, sharing of expertise, etc. In the Western Cape, this function is currently being carried out by the Green Cape, a special purpose vehicle under the Western Cape Department of Economic Development and Tourism. It is assumed that the government building energy efficiency program will be extended to the provincial and local level, which we would really appreciate. It must be noted, though, that one of the biggest barriers to government building retrofits is that public sector financial management systems do not allow for greater capex, upfront capex, that will lead to decreased opex over longer periods of time. This issue and the lack of available capex to undertake these projects needs to be addressed as part of this flagship program. Clarity is also sought on the transport flagship program, whether it will also aim to promote and support non-motorized transport, such as walking and cycling, especially for rural communities, and whether modes of transport such as scooters will be given some form of priority. It is assumed that part of the passenger modal shift approach will include improving the conditions and affordability and safety of public transport. In supporting the implementation of an efficient vehicle program, it is suggested that work needs to be undertaken with the vehicle industry in South Africa to bring the country in line with Euro 4 and 5 standards. Excuse me. In addition, the greening of the government fleet could be further strengthened by the introduction of driver behavior programs to promote more fuel-efficient driving and lead to the longer lifespan of vehicles. On mainstreaming climate resilience development, the White Paper plans for the National Climate Change Response Policy to be reviewed every 5 years, with the carbon budgets being reviewed every 2 years. Due to the nature of the sector and the rapid changes that are taking place at an international level, it is requested that the policy be reviewed internally on a more regular basis to ensure it's in line with international commitments. It needs to be noted that in the Western Cape, a sustainable energy bill is in the process of being drafted and will assist in coordinating the adaptation and mitigation responses across the provincial government departments and municipalities within the province. The challenge, again, will, however, be in supporting the implementation of the initiatives, and for this we request support from national government. The White Paper suggests that it may be useful to assign specific powers for mitigation and adaptation to local government. It must be noted that more importantly than simply assigning the mandate for these actions will be the provision of financial and human resources to undertake these functions at a local government level. The proposal to encourage best practice knowledge sharing across the provinces and municipalities is highly supported and will help with the above. The proposed approach to review the financial mechanisms to support capital and operating expenditures are supported for both the provincial and local government level. The National Treasury, we request that they enable financial models to allow for increased capex with payback through decreased opex for joint funding models, etc. While the White Paper notes that civil society needs to critically evaluate, comment on, and respond to the initiatives of government and the private sector, it is suggested that the role of civil society goes beyond this to being key partners in implementing and managing these projects. And then lastly, there's a concern that the carbon taxes may impact significantly on poor communities. While the White Paper does state that measures will be put in place to minimize these impacts, there is concern that industry and business will simply pass these costs of the carbon tax onto consumers, who may in any case not be able to afford the increased costs. It suggested that a more detailed study by National Treasury together with other stakeholders be undertaken before such taxes are imposed. To alleviate the concern regarding how the money that is collected will be used to support climate-related programs, it is suggested that the funds collated through the carbon tax be ring-fenced for specific climate change adaptation or mitigation programs under a central climate change funding mechanism for the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That is a very detailed input, which is important and interesting. Course asks a lot of questions, which worries me a little bit, because that means that particularly yourselves, like a Department of Environment in the provinces, I would have hoped National Department would have consulted you guys a bit more. But that's not a criticism, that's just an observation. But I think there's a lot of issues have been raised there. Any questions, any responses, any comments? Dr. Morgan? Dr. Zeus and Mrs. Kosana, so far, and Mrs. Ndule.
Thanks, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. It does ask a lot of questions, which I think in many respects is very useful. I'm not sure how far the white paper itself would seek to provide all the answers, but I accept that a lot of questions would flow out of it. And in some respects, and I mean, this is particularly a presentation that I would hope actually the National Department would get a copy of, Jefferson, because in some way the relevant questions are questions which need to be actively taken note of by the implementers, and I guess not just lost, not that I say they would be lost, but not potentially just lost in our own deliberations. In some sense, there should be a checklist of these type of things and how they're going to get responded to. So I don't think it's a specific question at all to the Western Cape government. Just to say that, I mean, I think the presentation should actually be bumped upwards to the department as well for some very specific answers. I suspect many of these things there are no answers to yet, quite frankly. I mean, as I said, Chair, the White Paper probably doesn't seek to provide answers at this stage to all of these things. But there are relevant points about implementation and particularly intergovernmental coordination, and I think we need to take note of them. But just what concerns me more is that the department needs to take note of them as well. Thank you.
I think we must be careful. You know, I and this is not a criticism to you. You know, the one thing I know about civil servants is they'll see a plan, they'll say we like it, we'll do it, but now we want the funding. And I think we must be careful about that because, I mean, that is why you're asking a lot of these questions quite correctly, is a lot of these are policies that are going to stay in the departments where they're now. That's why they're not in the paper. This policy paper is an overarching policy paper to fill in gaps on issues that don't exist. Like all the institutional arrangements that have to be done. The whole carbon pricing, that doesn't exist today. So those are the new things that this policy paper, and then it tries and pulls together some of the other policies and prioritizes them. But I think that one thing we have to get across to government is that in some instances there's going to be new money. I mean, for the carbon pricing, that's going to have to be a system that's going to be set up and there's going to be money for that. But for a lot of the other projects, that's going to come from the budgets that exist. I mean, whether we move from freight to rail, you know, whether we move to public transport, that is naturally going to come. And there may be some speeding up of it by more money. But I think the partners must realize, in provinces and local government, that there isn't something now that says there's a white paper, now we're going to have a whole new budget on the white paper on time, and this is now going to be... I think we must. I think what departments and provinces must be clever is where the white paper is strong on improving and filling gaps. There, of course, to push new projects and programs to see if there is funding available to do so. But I don't think, unless we have an adaptation fund, this paper doesn't say so. But I do hope there's an adaptation fund at some stage. That's one of the things we're going to raise as a committee that wasn't mentioned in the paper. Because that becomes a little bit difficult to deal with, because particularly if there's an international one, how on earth will we be able to access money if we don't have a fund where we can then process it properly and so on, money doesn't disappear. But I do think, and this is a general comment I make to all government departments that raise this issue with me, that we must be careful in terms of thinking there's going to be huge new budgets available. I mean, the white paper doesn't do that at all. So I just wanted to add to what Mr. Morgan is saying, and I do support all the things he's saying about the reference of this app. Mrs. Kusana?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I thank the presentation from the province that is hosting us here, Western Cape. Chairperson, I was listening very much attentively to the presenter. But the manner in which the document was presented here, it seems the province, it has got some other issues that don't really understand in the the white paper or is questionable in the white paper, and of which I should think provinces are the wings of the national department, and of which we expect a uniform of an approach on this matter of climate change. I thought, Chairperson, maybe I will hear more on the awareness part of it in relation to climate change in the province itself, and also the issue of COP17. How far has the province gone on this matter in making an awareness and plans, and also the small farmers and other poor communities who are really affected by this climate change? Is there any plans as a province? Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions, Ms. Ndude still?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I must say that it is a well prepared document. But I also note a number of questions. I would also align myself with the comments by the Chair to say it is not a criticism to the department, but I think it should be an observation that this committee is making, to say that it will be important that the provinces are also taken on board. Maybe the suggestion that is saying that they should, they're going to be establishment of a climate change, focus committee or whatever, it should have provincial representatives in that committee, so that you make sure that the provinces are also, part, they understand things from the, as you are saying, that they are supposed to be wings of the national government. It is important also that the national department take their sister, counterparts in the provinces to be part of the process, so that we do not have a situation where we have got a number of questions that are being questioned in the white paper. One of the observations that I'm also making here on the adaptation, you talk about the targets on adaptation, for instance, to say that the white paper is not clear on those. I know that in some of the presentations that you've received, I recall in some of the readings that I was doing in some of the presentations, they also raised, this issue, Chairperson, of that the white paper is not very clear, on the targets, on that. I think that's something that we also need to highlight in us preparing our own reports on the climate change. What are the, our own lessons that we have learned from the presentation. So when we compile our own report, we also need to be able to highlight the common things that were coming from the different, parties that came to make, the presentations. But having said that, I think the province is also government in the province. It will be important also for us to understand, or maybe to, to share with us your own commitment as a provincial, government, in terms of what are the things that you are doing to be able to meet, this process or this policy, halfway, and what are the your own as a provincial, what are the provincial vision on climate change, and what are the programs that the province is actually doing, besides maybe raising a number of questions in the white paper. What is your own program, here in the province that is actually, driving the awareness of, program in your own citizens in the province without waiting for the national government? Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Ms. Davies, you can respond.
Thanks very much for the comments. They are greatly appreciated. I think, first of all...
Sorry, let me just ask you, when you do give your input, just tell us to what extent you have been drawn into consultations over, as a provinces, not just you, but the provinces.
Yeah,
to what extent you are drawn in or not drawn into these processes?
I'm the Director of Climate Change at Province. I've only been in the provincial government since the end of February this year, but we've had very little engagement in the white paper. We had engagement in some of the workshops around the green paper, and then things kind of went underground from our perspective. Where the provinces have been pulled together is myself and our counterparts have been pulled together bi-national to set up the provincial COP summit, and that has been fantastic in terms of being able to work with other provinces to actually share ideas, share programs, who's doing what, and I think I would really encourage that we do that on a much more regular basis.
So to a certain point there were consultations and then they petered off.
Yeah, and I think some of the issues came when the comments on the initial white paper came through. I think there were a lot of comments, and I think due to time frames, etc.
Started, okay.
Yeah.
No. At least there was something.
Yeah, no, there was definitely something. And the comments we raised here, we're very much trying to say these are the issues that we saw back.
Well, the white paper is very different from the green paper, so yeah. If you weren't part of that process, that's why you're asking the question.
Yeah.
No, that's okay. Okay.
Do put forward that the funding and capacity support issue for us is the big issue, and I think it's going to be the issue across all provinces. We've just been running roadshows, which I'll go into further detail now in terms of our response to COP. But we had a provincial summit for about 300 people in Cape Town, which covered all sectors, and we then ran mini summits across the different districts, and those were focused on one day, which was with municipal officials from each of the districts, and the second day with community groups. In that summit with municipal officials, the word is coming out very strongly there. They understand why they need to be doing this work, but they simply are so short of capacity at the moment. We're asking them even to help us with gathering data on what projects are being rolled out, gathering data on energy consumption, and some of this data should be being collected by electricity departments and simply isn't. So they're actually struggling to meet their existing mandates, and they're coming to us and saying they see this as an unfunded mandate. So from our side, that's very much where we're trying to push. I know the provincial government side of things, for example, in energy efficiency, where we're trying to look at retrofitting buildings, the big challenge there is CapEx up front. We've got our education, health, other departments crying out for funds, and retrofits of building for energy efficiency at the moment is not seen as a priority. From my side, I would love it to be seen, and we keep pushing. But that's the brick wall we keep hitting, and that's the reality of where we sit at the moment. In terms of the adaptation fund, the question you raised there, my understanding is that SANDI will be the national coordinating body for the adaptation fund for South Africa. So it's the South African National Biodiversity Institute. To hear a little bit more around awareness raising around COP 17, as I said, we held a provincial summit. We then held district-level summits across the five districts, and we also met with the Metro, City of Cape Town. We're busy rolling out or printing off a lot of awareness-raising campaign material, which will be sent to all the districts. And that's based off, there's a Climate Smart Cape Town campaign, which has been, it's a membership of 23 partners, or members of which the provincial government is one. And so there's a lot of awareness-raising material that's come out of that we're helping to disseminate. We're also disseminating some of the material from national government's campaign. We ran a media training workshop last week. We had 60 representatives from media, everything from radio stations to big print media, community papers, etc., raising awareness around climate change, around what COP17 is about, what are the contentious issues, what are the things that might need to be reported on, and help them bring that down to a local level. To understand what kind of projects are happening on the ground so that they can give exposure. We're also busy putting together a media booklet, which is, we've got gathered some projects from across the province related to either climate change, adaptation, or mitigation. The idea there is just to give a summary of what those projects are and contact details, and again, that will be handed out at COP itself, and that's largely to give exposure to those projects. Media are going to be looking for stories to talk about, so it's trying to get them to actually show what's happening locally on the ground. And then we'll also be part of an expo at COP17 itself, and very much trying to give the voice of local and provincial government at COP17. In terms of,
can you also just on that issue, you said you're responsible for climate change in the province.
Yes.
I hope all provinces have got someone like you. But, it will be interesting. This white paper is now continuous. It's the start of a process. So I would hope that, and if you can tell your counterparts as well, and I'll ask national government also to tell your counterparts, it's very important that you become the eyes and ears also of things happening around climate change. So so that we can call you in as well and say, well, look, provincial level, where, you know, what's happening at local government, so that we can see whether things are actually moving on the climate change. And I would hope that that very much you also play the focal point in your province. You know, some lady came here yesterday. She does, she's a small-scale farmer in Swellendam and so on. And it's very clear to me that there's no engagement by your Department of Agriculture with farmers in the province to discuss issues of climate change. How will it impact? What will it do? What kind of crops? If this becomes drier and drier, you know, what are the best crops to think about now already? So it would be important, I think, it would be important for provinces and someone like you that's handling that climate change to actually become like we become in the accountable structure for government, to come and tell us what's happening at throughout the country. That in the provinces you guys have similar programs, and that you start, I imagine through the Premier's office, I don't know how you guys work, but to try and start making sure that the different departments are actually doing specific things around climate change. Because if we don't do that, then this is all going to come to naught. If we do not capacitate our people to respond to climate change, then it'll just be a government response. And to some extent, a response we enforce on mainly business and so on as well. So that's more a comment than anything else, but I'm going to ask national government or the national department to definitely try and see that provinces, local governments have champions for climate change so that they become people that have skills in this area, understand the issues, and you know, particularly if you want to pull people together and talk about climate change, that actually people that are on the ground say, but this is what's happening, this is what's not happening, so I know what's happening in my province or my local government, etc. So it's more a comment really than if you want to say something, it's fine. But
yeah, thanks for that. And I can respond is, in terms of the other provinces, I have a counterpart in other provinces, but all of us cover more than one. We don't just cover climate change. I think there are very few, if any, that cover only climate change. And that can be a challenge as well. I think in terms of your comments about bringing together other departments, we have set up what's called a climate change working group under our strategic objectives within the province. And that climate change working group, I think currently, which I chair, I have representatives from economic development and tourism, agriculture, transport and public works, human settlements, Department of Human Settlements, Department of Health, our Department of Environmental Affairs and Development Planning. And I think that's all at the moment. But essentially what we're trying to do, and it's very early days, is trying to get that cross-cutting nature. Where we're at the moment is trying to get a database together of all the projects that those departments are doing that are related to climate change. We'll then need to look at the climate change targets that we've set, and we have set ourselves targets, and see where the gap is. So quantify the projects that have been done, look at the targets and where's that gap, and what is the most effective way that we can look to close that gap. The question of our targets is going to be very reliant on what national targets are. So if national does get finance and technology support, and it goes to 34% decrease in energy by 2020, we're going to need to readjust our targets quite significantly, but we also need to have quite a hard think about how we can reach those targets. So the plan is there to work more with departments. I think, yeah, we still have a long way to go. And what we also need to do is look strategically as the climate change unit, which has literally only just been set up. There was one person when I arrived. We've brought on another three people within the last 2 months. So very new. And what we need to do strategically is look at where is our support required for other provincial departments and then for municipalities. Something that's sorely lacking in municipalities is a climate change champion. There are people that are interested enough to come to workshops, but then when you raise the question about being a climate change champion, they're ready to run out the room. They very much see this as additional to the work that they do. And that's the challenge we have. One idea we have discussed with a couple of the district municipalities is that if we can somehow find funding for a person who's got the right expertise, to have them as a roaming capacity for each district, so they can cover four or five municipalities. But again, it's how we find that funding. What we're trying to do as well at the moment is pull together a database of what funding nationally or internationally is available for climate change related work. How do we access that? What kind of projects attract that kind of funding? But we're finding that it's quite a difficult thing. There's a lot of pots of funding. How you actually access them is another question. Hence our call for, once the climate fund becomes available, to make it as accessible as possible to those in need. There was a question as well in terms of the programs that we're running. On the mitigation front, the energy efficiency, our key focus there at the moment we'd like to see is the resource efficiency or energy efficiency of our own public sector buildings. Our biggest challenge there at the moment is CapEx and also the financial management models of some of the systems that we want to put in place have 5-year paybacks, and those don't work within financial management systems. We're also looking to work with 4 municipalities initially in this next financial year to help them develop sustainable energy plans to look at where are their biggest areas of energy use and spend and what are the initiatives they can be putting in place to reduce that. We also, on the renewable energy side, the Green Case, the SPV under the Economic Development Department, are driving the renewable energy sector within the Western Cape. At the moment, focused on large-scale wind farms. It'll move towards large-scale PV farms, looking to a certain extent solar water heater, local manufacture, skills development, etc. And the idea down the line is to look at further localized small-scale production. A lot of their time is spent lobbying with national governments around some of the legislative and other barriers. And there we really call for support from national. The whole energy agenda has been driven by a number of different parties. And we're very keen to drive renewable energy forward, but just need to have a little bit of help in terms of unblocking certain barriers. And then on the adaptation front, the Department of Agriculture is busy doing work on sustainable farming practices, on more water resource efficient practices, but I bear your comment in mind that those aren't necessarily getting out, and that's something we need to work with them on. We've also done sea level rise studies for 2 of the coastal areas in the province, and we're busy doing the 3rd coastal area now. The idea is to work with the local municipalities then in terms of what the results are showing and what that means for them in terms of where they approve developments and where they need to put in flood defense systems.
My golf course is busy washing away. Please bear that in mind. Romerton. The club comes and talks to me all the time and say, why doesn't the municipality want to put things here? So please bear that in mind. My golf course is not going to be there for much longer if you keep on putting barriers up there. The loony greeny in the part of the
mind. No, 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 no.
Oh,
I'm
my
saying,
God.
I'm saying where it is situated.
That's David Graaf's problem. The Graaf family sold that land.
That's just a question of development. If it's an area that is likely to be flooded with increased sea level rise, you're saying just look at keeping development away, because it's often local government who's going to be taken to task.
We keep on raising that problem with local government. You're quite right.
And then adaptation plan.
What happened under apartheid, this bloody golf course? Apartheid's fault.
And the adaptation plans, municipalities need support there as well in developing adaptation plans, and that's a whole area of work we need to work on them with. I think that's all.
No, thanks. Look, that's good stuff. I'm glad you've come, because it's made me ask a whole lot of questions to myself. It's very clear that although there is a part in the paper that talks a bit about local government, it seems to me that what we're going to have to look at as a committee, and I'm really coming to the committee, is to what extent we want to see how we can actually create structural changes at provincial and capacity at provincial and local government. And maybe that reason for legislation, where one can then spell this out and create these obligations and these possibilities. Particularly the one about champions, the more I sit and the more I think how important it becomes. Because you can imagine what's going to happen in municipalities and provinces where there aren't people like that. That kind of coordination is just not going to take place. So thanks a lot. Your input's given much food for thought. Obviously, we've looked also provincial and local. So thanks for the effort. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Now the troublemakers, Busa, the polluters. Busa's been here before, you know the drill. 10 to 15 minutes, and then we will vigorously engage the polluters. Good morning.
Morning, Chairman, honorable members. Chair, I've come to you today not as a polluter, but as a partner of this new road that we need to travel.
So, I'd like to hear that.
So, Chair, I'm not going to comment really on the white paper, but to discuss with you the challenges that we believe are going to be faced in the implementation thereof and the kind of things we think could be done about it. We're pleased to see that the white paper recognizes the private sector as a potential partner in addressing the challenges that we're going to face. We will be signing, as Busa, a Green Economy Accord tomorrow with government, and we hope that we will use that also as a platform for signing more specific agreements on various aspects. But without doubt, the transition to a low-carbon economy is a national imperative. The question is how best can we do it without negative impact. Now, the white paper we need to understand fundamentally changes the structure of our economy. We need to understand that because to deny that is not to move forward. So we need to understand that that is what it's going to do. The question is, how do you do it in such a way that potential negative impacts are mitigated? And you can always do things in more than one way, and if you do it in one way, it has less negative impact than if you do it in another. And that's the kind of discussion that we think we should be having. You are right, Chair, when you say significant thinking is required here. Very serious thinking. That is 100% correct. And we need to do that thinking collaboratively. It's so that we've got all the stuff on the table and we see how can we work together to achieve what we need to achieve. I think that's really quite an important message. One of the things, of course, which always remains a problem is the challenge of coherence amongst government departments at the national level in particular.
Previous input shows that to some extent.
I think
and between two environmental departments, there's not always the kind of coherence that there should be.
Exactly. Now, the first part of the implementation is that the private sector needs to be recognized as part of the solution. Of course, we're part of the problem. There's no question about it. But we're also part of the solution. So I think that's an important consideration.
And you can take this committee accepts 100%.
That's good. I'm pleased with that, Chair. Now, the Copenhagen commitment is, and you're correct in that assumption, it is. But it's based on the collective outcome of a number of actions. That's how it's derived, and that's the intention. That we will not do one single action, like not build the sea. We will do a number of different actions in different sectors, and that is the absolute foundation of the commitment. The conditionalities can be seen, I think, as analogous to the support mechanisms which the government has already started to develop to support industrial policy. The conditionalities, in a way, are an international support mechanism. That of course, we must exploit as best we can, but we must not rely on it as we don't get it, we do nothing. That's not the intention at all. But it would be, I think it would be irresponsible of us not to try to access that funding where it exists. Of course, given the state of the world today, one's not sure that there'd be a huge flux. So we need to look for our own mechanisms. We already have a number of
carrot and a stick.
I think so.
I mean, in some areas, if we want people to adapt, we may have to give incentives. In other areas, we must take the lut and slatel a chat.
No, there's no doubt about that. I couldn't disagree with you on that because from a
just not so crudely put, but
it's real.
Yeah.
I think, Chair, the thing is also from a collective business point of view, we don't want bad guys. We want everyone to be good guys. It's not realistic. So you can't achieve this kind of change without the state.
Yeah.
There's no question. If we look at the supporting instruments that we already have in respect of DTI, now new, tax allowances for new investments include the concept of energy efficiency. So you don't get the same benefit if you're not energy efficient in a new development. So we think those kind of things are important. We're working with them now on a new competitiveness measure. Competitiveness for a South African firm today includes addressing mitigation. And depending what sector, also maybe adaptation. So there's no question about it. Those are the things that we've got to do. Now, if we look at what are the key elements of a transition to a low-carbon economy? The first one is you must have an accurate and up-to-date national emissions inventory.
That we strongly support.
There's absolutely no doubt about it. There's, I think, no argument about it. You must have an emissions reduction trajectory, an overarching one, so that you look every year at how have you performed against it. I'll speak a little bit more about such a trajectory. You've also got to know who must do what, why, and when. So you can't have a situation where you don't allocate responsibility. So that's an important thing also. As we develop the individual plans, mitigation plans, company and sector level, we've got to understand the risks, we've got to understand the costs, and we've got to understand the opportunities. Now, the white paper recognizes this in a number of its proposals. You're also going to have market instruments, but I'm going to come to the regulatory. We're going to have that too. So, Chair, if we look at the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory, and here I think it's important to note, you referred to the massive increase in greenhouse gas emissions from 1997 to 2009. Of course, it is largely as a result of industrial growth, of industrial activity, but it is also as a result of better data collection. So the full 150 is not due to increased emitting activity, if I could call it that.
That's a good point.
So now the other
more accurate we get, the more we'll know exactly how many.
Exactly, and it's important that when you're looking at allocating responsibility, that you understand that you're never 100% accurate here. No country in the world is 100% accurate on their emissions. So that this concept of a band of uncertainty is very important each side of the trajectory. What we also need to remember about the inventories, which we've done an inventory, official inventories, 1990, 94, 2000, all done significantly retrospectively. These are all published. We've worked with government on a 2009, so the data that you referred to, which will be published next year, we believe. All of those inventories were developed on the basis of voluntary submission of data by industry. All of them. Problem, voluntary submission of data will never give you 100% coverage. So we've never complete, even in 2009, we've not
complete. Oh, I hope it's inflated. If they were clever, they would inflate it, because then they would, later on when you put obligations on them, then they can easily meet the obligations.
I can't believe that you would think that anybody that is affiliated to Bruce could behave in fashion.
Now, I would absolutely think that. I've got no problem. There's not even a doubt that crosses my mind. This is not even a leap of faith like we had earlier. This is just truth.
Well, my problem is that I've probably got a leap of faith that I don't believe it. But I understand it.
No, the points you're making are valid, and we accept that, and I hope in the next 2 years we'll push government to get those things tied down much more.
Correct. So we absolutely agree that the provision of that data must be mandatory. No doubt about it at all. We have a MOU with government on the voluntary submission of data. We're in the process of concluding a new one, which we'll conclude by the end of this month, which says how we will work together with them on their project to develop the web-based reporting template and how we'll commit to that. And of course, once that is up and running, the collection of data will be, or the provision of data will be mandatory. I'm always worried, Chair, when I hear of collection of data at municipal and provincial level as well, for companies to report the same matter more than once to different spheres of
data. No, that's not acceptable.
It's really,
we would want it to be a central database.
100%.
And the government must make sure you can't use weak structures to try and create extra obligations there, and they don't have the expertise.
Correct. So we would support,
we'll support you doing it at a national level.
Now, Chair, the emissions reduction...
Otherwise, it'll be a disaster.
No, it will be a disaster, Chair. Now, the emissions reduction trajectory. This approach, and we need to understand it, the approach essentially caps the emissions. It sets a national cap that says we can't go beyond it. The challenge with it is that it's not there. It's still based on the LTMS data. The projection is based on the LTMS projection, where the GDP growth was projected from about 98-99. So we perhaps didn't do as well in some years, we did better in some years. That is a challenge for us. We must remember also that, and it's correct what Liz says, our task here is to achieve economic growth. The national plan says 5.4% per annum. We this year will be lucky to get to 3. But you've got to uncouple the emissions growth. The LTMS assumed a one-to-one relationship, that for each unit of GDP growth, you had an equivalent unit of emissions growth. That's how the projection was made. We've got to separate those projections.
But that's why we've got an orange and a green.
Correct. But now,
so if you just do it a one-on-one, you'll get the orange growth. If you do the
100%.
You decap them and do it differently, then you'll only get the green. You'll never get the green one otherwise.
No, you've got to uncouple it. Now, but you've got to uncouple it in the right way. Let's take, for example, energy intensive. We are significantly energy intensive economy for various reasons. But if you look at the IRP and the energy intensity trajectory over the last 10, 15 years, you'll see that our energy intensity has decreased. But it's not a good energy intensity decrease, because it's as a result of an increase in the tertiary sector, which is not labor absorbing and is not energy intensive. So in the same way that it's not labor absorbing, it's also not energy intensive. So the manufacturing sector is shrinking, and as a result, you've got the reduction in energy intensity. Our challenge is to bring the energy intensity down, carbon intensity down, and keep manufacturing
up. The energy use different.
Correct. So that's really something that we have to do. We've got, because this emissions reduction trajectory, in a sense, caps the emissions on the economy, we have to be sure that we understand what it is and how it's made up. The white paper recognizes that there must be some refinement, and we think that's part of the 2 years' work that we must embark upon. Now, the refinement requires a number of things. We must agree the approach to the uncertainty, because if you look at the orange and the green, the orange is an ever-increasing uncertainty as you go into the future. The green is a fixed uncertainty as you go into the future. You can't calculate a deviation from lines that are so different in their nature. So it's those kind of things that we've got to get straight in our heads, that we've got a good understanding of it. We must take our...
Well, the whole green trajectory, if we really want to be, the whole green trajectory is uncertain,
yes,
in the sense that it's based on science that comes from the LTMS,
yes,
which may not be our ultimate obligation when there's a world agreement made.
I think, Chair, that...
When a world agreement is made, we may have a completely different target. We'll have to relook all this in any case. It either may be up or down from what we're saying now.
If you look
at the green, when they can put it up later.
Yes.
The blue part of it,
yeah,
is what we promised at Copenhagen.
Right.
Within the green. The red part is what Cabinet agreed to in 2008 at the Cabinet Lekgotla, which slightly fine-tune the president's Copenhagen promise.
Correct.
And that is why the green encompasses all of them.
Yes.
Because with the green trajectory, all the promises we made are then within the green.
Correct.
But the fact that, firstly, there may be uncertainties on the correctness of our emissions at any given time, and secondly, because we have chosen a target for ourselves, that target clearly may be something that could change in the future if a world agreement were to be reached. So even by 2012, this whole review they want to do internationally, and then by 2000, take everyone's promises plus the Kyoto Protocol obligations, look at that and say, well, this is what we're going to say each one must. That men may change.
Exactly.
So we must be aware that there's a lot of assumptions created in the green band.
Correct.
Which may in future, when things become more certain, may change. And you may have actually have a much lower trajectory than we have now. Or higher.
It could. And Chair, that is why it is so imperative for us to have a sustainable methodology of all the time looking what is possible, bottom up, a collection of bottom up actions as in our commitment, and a top down limit, if I could call it that. That iteration is an ongoing iteration that must happen, and we've got to have an agreed methodology to do it. And I'll show you some figures now. We can't have a situation that if Eskom works out the numbers, they get X, we work out the numbers, we get Y, government works out the numbers, we get Z. We can't have that. We've got, given the uncertainty, which we all accept, we've got to have an agreed way of measuring the uncertainty, agreed way of measuring the numbers. I think
one of the ways as a committee that we started raising, we haven't looked at it clearly, I've even raised it with the minister and she seems to think it may be a good idea, and that is legislation.
Sure.
You don't just have policies that are vague with assumptions. You actually create legislation that can spell out a lot of the methodology how this will be done.
Chair, we are not afraid of legislation in this area, as long as we've got a common platform.
Everyone knows what the law is, basically.
Exactly. So we think that's an important piece of work to be done. If I use this as an example, because I think we need to agree there's not a right or a wrong number here. There's a range of numbers. Now, the reality is 2009 we already at 540 billion tons, as you said, that's a massive increase. This is an estimate, they may do better. But on Medupi and Kusile alone, we're talking 30 million tons each. The one will come, but we hope, in 2013, but maybe 2014 will be fully operational. Kusile 17, 18. We already then at that time had 6 tons. In 2020, the lower limit 398, upper limit 583. So as you say, you've already seen these numbers in a sense in saying we're going to struggle to meet that trajectory. But I don't show these numbers to illustrate that. I show these numbers to illustrate the importance of understanding where is it possible, where are the constraints, how do you deal with them, where are the challenges. It's that message that I really would like to convey. If we look at Eskom's presentation to this committee, they are talking about 693 million tons in 2020 and 655 in 2025. They derive that from the integrated resource plan. It's a different way of coming to a number, and you can see the significant difference of the number, because 93 million tons in 2 years is then we're really not doing anything. So there's a challenge with the numbers that we've got to get to grips with. I also want to show this also to show the absolute imperative of separating emissions growth from GDP growth. These lines here are the green band in the trajectory that we've spoken about. This is a projection of GDP growth against that. Here's a 2% growth, here's a 3.5% growth. Here's, of course, a very optimistic 7% growth, but it's the kind of number in the new growth path. The national plan is between that at 5.4. So you can see that if you want to achieve the growth
economic growth that is required to deal with the matter of unemployment, particularly, and of course eradication of poverty, you've got to get that uncoupling right. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen. So otherwise, you're going to pull your GDP down, and which is what you really don't want to do. Now, the allocation of responsibility. Now, here, in the same sort of the emission trajectory sets an upper limit on the whole economy. The carbon budget essentially allocates individual caps to sectors and companies, which if you want to regulate, you ultimately have to go to the company level. Now, the challenge here is that if it's not done in a collaborative way, we don't understand what we're doing, it can have very serious industrial policy implications. Now, the manufacturing sector went to do the DTI 4 years ago and said, you need to include greenhouse gas mitigation in your industrial policy action plan. It is still not adequately included in there. We're saying that it is imperative that these economic departments, not only Treasury are looking at carbon price, but DTI and economic development must be part of this discussion. So that on the one hand, you have the industrial policy situation relative to the emission reduction that you have to achieve. You can't, for example, without engagement, on the one hand, have a beneficiation strategy which introduces 10 new commodity value chains, each of which are energy intensive. The titanium value chain requires 10 times more energy than aluminium per ton produced. 10 times more. You can't have that document on the one hand and this document on the other. You've got to work to bring them together. And that is a really fundamental message which I think perhaps is in our reading of what is going on in terms of government policy, that synergy has not come together as it needs to. So we think that's important. Of course, we want to be involved in this, but we want to be involved not to be saying we can't do it. We want to be involved to say we have to do it. What is best for us? It's that kind of approach. So we think that's a very important consideration. Now,
well, I hope they keep you there because then it'll happen.
Yeah.
When they put some other one there, you see, then, and someone else in government that's new, and they start all over and talk a lot. So you better just stay there. You better just stay there. You want trouble from us, you must leave. Then we'll see.
So have I graduated from Venus, Jim?
You're graduating slowly but surely.
Now, the risk, costs, and opportunities. There's a number of ways that we can do it, and I think that it's probably good if we agreed some methodologies together as how we should do it. There's a lot of assessments proposed in the white paper. We think it's a bit light on methodology, so we think that's an important consideration. We think important also to learn from others. A number of countries have done carbon budgeting or some other form of responsibility allocation. We think we need to do that. There's opportunities here. There's opportunities that we must exploit. But to use Liz's example of the, if I may, Liz, of the solar water heating component manufacturers that are going out of business, that is an example of industrial policy not matching a renewable energy objective of government. We are speaking to government about this because we are saying you cannot support your local manufacturing industry if you do not have much better border control, import control. On the quality of the goods, on the safety of the goods, these are areas, in fact there's a workshop next week to discuss how we can do it, but it's just an illustration of the imperative of industrial policy and greenhouse gas mitigation being absolutely aligned and moving forward together. It's an imperative. Otherwise, we will lose out on the green economy opportunities. We just won't be able to seize it. So we think that's important. We recognize, as the new growth path does, that there's going to be trade-offs to be made here. And we're going to need to have the correct information so we can make an informed trade-off. Now, the market instrument. Now, I must say, Chair, that the matter of the carbon tax, I think the business, how business saw it in February and how National Treasury saw this matter in February, where we were on completely different sides of the table, I think through very solid and intensive engagement, we are moving to convergence. We are not there. But Treasury has done a significant amount of work. The impact of electricity prices, for example, because if they impose the tax on the electricity input, it's pure and simple pass-through. As is the current, we have currently a fossil fuel levy on electricity generated from fossil fuel. It's currently set at 25 rand a tonne. That levy is imposed at the level of Eskom, passed straight to the tax. There's no behaviour mitigation as a result of the imposition. We understand the technical difficulty of imposing a tax at the company level because of the different emissions that the company has, different types of emissions. They may have direct process emissions. They may have emissions from waste. They will certainly have energy consumption emissions, different types of energy, primary energy carrier. So those kinds of things you have to take into account in the design. But we think if you really want to make an impact, you've got to tax where you want to change the behavior. So that discussion is still ongoing.
So the one good thing, even if that happens, the one good thing of that is that electricity is going to be more expensive, and at least your alternative forms of energy then have a chance to start competing.
Yeah.
I mean, your renewables are now more expensive. If the whole idea of the white paper is to price carbon,
yeah,
and thereby force behavioral change through the creation of budgets, sector things, carbon taxes, the reason for that is to make carbon less attractive.
That's true, Chair. But
do it in a way it doesn't create unintended consequences.
The impact currently on manufacturing, especially small and medium manufacturing, of the very steep rise in electricity prices is really a great concern. At the time, you'll recall that the 3-year price increase period that we're in now, we're only in the second year, that originally Eskom asked for 45%. They were then persuaded that was a bad idea, so they asked for 35. Under influence of public input, it went to 25. But now comes another unintended consequence. So we're in the second year now, we'll go to the next 25 next year. Now, as a result of aggressive energy efficiency investment, the amount of electricity purchased from Eskom is less than what projected for the current year. Now, their approval, tariff approval from NERSA is based on revenue, not tariff. So NERSA says, you need X billion, we think it's too much, we'll give you X minus 20 billion. But they have to recover that revenue. Now, because they're not recovering the revenue, because we're using less electricity because we're more efficient, and also, to be fair, there's the economy is not that wonderful. They're not going to generate that revenue. So what are they going to do next year? They're going to go to NERSA and say, sorry, we're not getting the revenue. You must give us a bit higher unit cost. So the understanding that we have is that 25 will go to 33. In a municipal area, what will that be? Because they still add on to that. So there's another piece of work that we've got to do. How do you compensate, and particularly local government, how do you compensate the local authority for loss of revenue because of resource efficiency? Because you've got to compensate, otherwise the resource efficiency is not going to happen. And you can't just increase the price all the time. So that's why it's so important that these things are done holistically, that we look together at the thing. We think that in respect of, we agree that the carbon tax must be recycled, but that one we are not winning. I mean, that discussion we are having with Treasury all the time. Up to now, we haven't won it. It's imperative that we understand what is the role of the carbon tax is amidst a suite of other instruments. Because the carbon budget is an instrument of capping.
Yeah.
How does it relate to the tax? That synergy we also haven't managed.
Right.
We haven't managed to achieve yet. So if you look, for example, a carbon budget is essentially a national allocation plan.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Now, if you use national allocation plans also in trading schemes. It's the way that you do it. Now, in a trading scheme, generally what happens, you emit below your allocation, you can sell that business. You emit above, you can buy it. So that you it costs you more money if you don't achieve it. So it's not a tax, but it's, in a sense, a tax. Now, we're arguing that we accept that a trading scheme may be problematic domestically, at least in the beginning. We think it should be investigated, but it may have some challenges. But if you've got a cap on your emissions as a company and you're achieving that cap, you can't be taxed from your first ton, because you're already, to achieve the cap, you're for sure making very, very serious capital investments. So you can't, in a sense, get a double whammy, which is what would happen here. And this discussion, we think, requires much more intensity.
So you want options there?
Well,
the good ones, they should be incentives to on their own, and if you don't make it, then you get taxed if you do. Okay.
Exactly, it's
worth looking at.
I think exactly. So we're saying that let's have the discussion. Let's not close off the debate. Now, Chair, I just want to briefly speak about the flagship projects, because these are not new. But I think the good thing about them, we've been working on, I've just highlighted the ones where we're really doing significant work. What has happened, we have always argued we must be working on these things. If the white paper gives them a new impetus, that's good. Let's not knock it. Let's do it. And do it aggressively. And I think in all these areas we are doing that. Of course, with some of the challenges that we have, you'll see, Chair, I'm sure the Department of Energy will announce soon, that the call for proposals for bids on renewable energy were well oversubscribed. There's an eagerness to be investing in this sector. So I think that we're not doing too badly there. What do we need to do, Chair? We must get a rigorous methodology. We've got to refine the emission reduction trajectory. We've got to allocate responsibility. We must determine the risk costs of each of the elements of the transition, and we need to establish the synergies between the carbon tax and the carbon budget. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that input. Quite contrary to all the NGOs to say that we, the puppets of business, government and the opposition, are the puppets of business, and that we just mouth all your... I am glad that you've come and give this input. They can hear for themselves that... It's you that have placed business at a place where there's a project we have to work on nationally, and business is seeing its role in that project. And that we're not the lapdogs of business.
That you are not for sure,
Jay. It would be difficult to push me personally as a lapdog for business. I've been very, have great antipathy. Okay. That was a good input in the sense that there's a lot of things there to look at and discuss. Obviously, a lot of it is the principles in the white paper have been agreed to carbon pricing, and a lot of these issues are going to be debated in the next 2 years. I mean, the carbon tax hasn't been finalized, it's been engaged on, the whole way of how we're going to do carbon budgets, etc. So, and I think what business has projected is their approach to those issues and how they'll engage them, which has been a worthwhile process. Okay, any questions, clarity, comments that any member has? Mr. Morgan?
Thanks, Chairperson, and thanks to Bruce for the presentation. I appreciate it. And thank you for raising a number of very, very interesting points. I'm interested in something that you haven't particularly raised here, and I have no doubt you've done some work on it, is do you have any comments on sequencing in terms of the policy response to climate change? And by that I mean getting the order of policy responses correct, so sort of right policy at right time, in right order. I'm sure business would have a lot to add on that, because the white paper has a number of policy proposals, certainly. It doesn't necessarily say, well, we've deployed this now, we've deployed that then. And I think that is, I personally regard that as very, very important. I can only imagine the consequences of the right policy employed that's deployed at the wrong time could have devastating consequences. So I'd like you to talk us through your views on that. The next thing is the issue of time frames. Now, the white paper actually, I think to its credit, has a number of, for a number of subparts of this paper, suggests some time frames of when various things should be achieved. This is no doubt also very, very important. Hence, I'm interested from Boozer if you have any thoughts, particularly on the time frames, in terms of are they too ambitious, are they not ambitious enough? And also, linking to my first point, do the time frames in terms of sequencing actually work with each other as well? And I guess what I mean by that in a practical sense, well, if one thing's given a longer period of time than another, one could impact on the other. Then with regards to, I accept that a lot of work has to be done on the carbon budget of individual sectors. The white paper roots the concept of the carbon budget and doesn't provide all that much way forward. Not that I necessarily expect it to at this stage. I'm sure it would be the subject of more policy going forward. But I no doubt this is something that you engage on extensively. I'm interested from your understanding as business. And let's take an individual sector as an example, and you can choose the example. Once a budget is set for a sector, how would that budget practically be implemented and so for instance and sort of divvied up between the partners in that sector? It's not something I've necessarily applied my mind to, and I know I should, but I'm interested in how that is possible and what your thoughts are on that and practical ability. I suspect it could set people who are competitors within the sector against each other in a whole new kind of way. So I'd appreciate your comments on those things, and thank you once again for your presentation. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. Anyone else, Ms. Ndude? Anyone else?
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I must say that really we are coming a long way. And I think the lady is right, because I remember the last time that she appeared in front of this committee that we were really far apart from one another. We didn't leave one another in a good note. And I must say that this presentation today, I must say it has really moved a long way. It's very, very impressive, Chair. I must really make that comment. On your slide here, allocation of responsibilities, there you are talking about where you say unless done carefully could have unintended industrial policy implications. There you are talking about the carbon budget. My issue there is to try to understand such as what are those policy implications, such as what if maybe one can be able to give some examples, it will be very helpful. Thanks.
can I ask you a gut feeling? The green trajectory on that slide, I mean, we've discussed all the different uncertainties that may exist on that. Will your gut feeling be that the top end of the green thing would be, if you were to have the right carbon numbers, that it's going to be higher than that or lower than that? Just from a business perspective, bearing in mind the uncertainties and assumptions that create the green line, whether you think it's going to be much bigger higher up or quite a bit lower down. If you can't give a gut feeling, then it's fine. I don't expect anything scientific, but... Okay, over to you for responses, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the questions. I think the question of sequencing of the policy response is very important. I'd like the second question first to illustrate the challenge that I have. If you take all the activities in the white paper and you put them in a table and you put the time frame, I would say that there's no chance of doing all those things together in that time frame, because it's all related. So that's the first thing. So, and some are in a sense dependent on others. So, for example, if you emitted a mandatory reporting system for greenhouse gases, without doubt one has to do and must immediately start work on. We've agreed for some time that it must be done, and really what we would ask there, move forward with all speed. Because we've got numbers, so it's not that we can say, well, we must wait for that work to be finished, that we're collecting mandatory data before we start to do other work. But we're saying, before you regulate, you cannot have a voluntary emissions inventory which you use as the basis of a regulatory cap. You cannot. You have to have an official government number which you then divvy up before you can then divvy it up in legislation. So that is an example of where the sequence is important. But that doesn't mean that you don't start doing the divvying up work. Now, let me give you an example of an unintended consequence, perhaps, of doing the thing in the wrong way. And I'll use the chemical sector because I know it the best. We have a process operated by a number of companies where we produce nitric acid. It's a process that in that production process that produces nitrous oxide, so very high global warming potential. So its contribution to the emission trajectory is significant. Now those plants are, we've got about seven in the country and are constructing at the eighth. They all at a different age. If the older they are, the more difficult it is to backward engineer an abatement process. You can do it, but it's not as efficient, because the more integrated your production process and your abatement process engineering is, the more efficient it is and the better result you get on the emission abatement. So, for example, using the state-of-the-art technology to reduce nitrous oxide emissions, we can, on some plants, newer plants, reduce it by 80%. On a new plant, we'd probably be close to 90%, where the abatement is engineered as part of the initial construction. But we've got older plants where it's 50%. We can only get as far as 50%. Now, say you have a policy which says all nitric acid plants must reduce their emissions by 90%, because that's the upper benchmark of what is achievable. The unintended consequence, because I'm sure that the government would not regulate knowingly that they're going to close factories, especially not overnight, you would immediately then have a situation where those that can't meet the 90, which is probably most of them, would have to close, because they just can't do it. The technology does not exist for them to be able to do it. That's why the sequencing of the cap and the mitigation actions are so important. We must, as business, because we don't say to government, trust us, we're pure. We don't say that. But we say in the first instance, we know on a nitric acid plant what is possible and what isn't. Therefore, let's tell us we must develop these range of mitigation actions completely unfettered by a constraint. You brainstorm, you put everything down. Then you go through a process which says, well, can I do it in this year? You know, is it possible? Is the technology available to me in the next 5 years? Cool. Then let's say that's one that we put a tick against. We invest in it, we put it in. Carbon capture and storage is an example where we will not be able to implement it successfully in the next 5 years because we don't have the technology. But that doesn't mean that we don't put it down, because we must be introducing mitigation investments for the next 30, 50 years. What we're saying is let's start now with what is the best for us to do. Energy efficiency is a no-brainer. These kind of things we must do. Waste minimization, recycling of waste, all of these things are mitigation actions. Some of them, we don't even need support from the government because it's in the interest of business to do it. So you in your selection of priorities of mitigation action, you've got a timing thing. You've got a timing thing as to when would you regulate them. Regulating technology, of course, we don't like. We like rather to have the outcome regulated, and that we can, because more competitive, if we're allowed to choose our own intervention. I think that the most important thing out of this is that we must have an implementation plan. We have spoken to the government, to the department about it already. We're saying that there must be a comprehensive implementation plan. All of these actions and their time frames must be put down. We must be identifying where it's useful to work together, because some of the things you work together. What, for example, the Industrial Policy Action Plan is reviewed every year. They've just initiated the process for next year's review now. It's unlikely that we would get an output from work here that we could feed into next year's Industrial Policy Action Plan. But surely after a year, we would be able in the following Industrial Policy Action Plan to include something. So it's those kind of synergies on timeframes that one also needs to look at. So it's not only the actions here, it's the actions in other related departments. The Department of Energy, for example, will release probably this month still the revised National Energy Efficiency Strategy, which includes mandatory reporting on energy consumption, all energy consumption, not only electricity. Mandatory, they will still not do the regulation, but the strategy includes it. It will include mandatory energy management plans with company-level improvement targets for every consumer of electricity. We're talking industrial and mining. Every consumer above a threshold still to be decided. That kind of thing you have to link in to the work that you're doing here on the implementation of the white paper. So that's also very important consideration. The divvying up. Historically, there's two ways of doing it, and I think we have to use both. If you've got a cake and you want to divide it up amongst a group of people using a certain criteria, you can say, well, I'm going to give the eldest in the room the best, the most. So I'm going to give half of the cake to the oldest people in the room, and then I'm going to give the other, which may only be five people, and then I'm going to take the other half of the cake and I'm going to give it to I'm going to give a quarter to the youngest, and then I'm going to give the rest to those that remain. And those that remain, of course, are then on the short end of the thing. But now the whole cake is gone. Now a new person knocks on the door and says, but where's my cake? And you've got no cake left for that person. That's a fundamental difficulty of allocating all the space in one shot. Because you've got to, if you want to grow your economy, you've got to have space for a newcomer, a new entrant. And we also want to diversify our economy. We've got empowerment questions. So you have to not only work on the history. So you've got to, and quite often the history is how it's done. Another way that you could do it, you could say, you've also got to know, you can't have a situation where you say we cannot close down Eskom. We cannot close down London Airport in the next 20 years, we can't. But we've got to be saying, okay, as you said, Chair, as renewable rises, so we won't bring old ones back into service. We won't extend their life.
As they start using 80%, 60%, 40%, and then you close it down, that one's gone.
Exactly.
And hopefully something else is coming in place.
Correct.
On the renewable side.
And because the challenge with renewable is that for an industrial base like ours, you need power 24/7. Renewable cannot give you that. Not in our... the reason it can't give it to us here is we haven't got a smart grid. In Germany, it's still possible. So because their grid is very sophisticated, they can even bring electricity from other parts of Europe. So we need to understand that if you're going to use new forms of electricity, and there are many people that will tell you it's technically not possible, so that we would have to go to nuclear, which brings you a whole other debate. You need a certain amount of electricity for so-called base load. If you haven't got that, you haven't got an industrial base. You have not got an industrial base. So that also, when you look at policy and how you divvy up, you've got to look at that. Now, for example, on divvying up the integrated resource standard, electricity generation contribution to the greenhouse gas inventory in 2009 is 42%. That's only on the generation. The integrated resource plan allocates it a carbon space of between 50 and 60, depending which how you actually calculate it. That's not even based on historical. It's based on preemptive carbon budgeting through another policy instrument. That's also not the way to do it. You've got to have a single process. Everybody's subject to the same process. You've got an agreed methodology. I think that's important. Now, what the Europeans did, and the South Koreans to an extent had a similar thing. They said, let us look at all of these sectors. Let's benchmark what is possible. So my nitric acid example, how will I make sure that I've got a reasonable benchmark that I tell everybody in that sector they can strive for, if they all achieve it, what is the space? So I don't look historically what did they do, because the one may have been a better performer than the other in terms of emission reduction. I say, what is the average benchmark that's agreed then with the sector, and they say, okay. So some will say, if that's the way the world is going, I'm not going to build an extension to my plant. And in that way, you change the structure of your economy. You can't, that type of thing, you must set a longer term goal. I think the time frame here, I think we started too late, so I think the time frame here is a problem. I would say we will not meet the 2020 number, whatever it is. I think what's important for us is to show progress towards the number. You've got to show, and therefore you...
I'm very pragmatic in that way.
So
as long as things have been done and we're moving there, within a year or two later, I'm not going to.
Exactly.
For me, it's an issue. If we're 5 years down the line, we haven't done nothing yet.
With
a good intention, that's not my problem. But if we started doing stuff, we started moving to renewables,
cranking
up courses of these, and we do that. And that, you see, for me, I really am a snowball man. I believe that if you put a snowball on a hill, and get to the bottom, it's much bigger. Much faster than
the
start of
the
top.
Exactly. So
it's
important.
There's some momentum. There's an internal logic to things. You get
to
a tipping point.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's simple for me. We said to Eskom here, we were you. We will never again use the word coal. We will only talk about renewables and saying this is the future. Because you're locked in with coal for a certain period of time. No one's going to take that away from you. So you don't have to mention that. You don't have to defend it. It's there. What you must do is start saying, well, we're still considering coal for the future. That's where you get into problems. If you're saying, no, we're on this trajectory part of government, so our main focus is we think we must move towards No one is going to attack you for the fact that you're going to conceal it and think, well, somebody can see the few enemies. But, you know, the fact of the matter, that is a locked in policy. It's there.
Exactly.
It's gonna, until they get mothballed, it's there. But what you need to do is you need to project that future.
Yes.
And I think that's what, I mean, any clever industry, once you see where we're going,
yeah,
and that this economy, forget climate change, that this economy is going to be a winning economy if you move to new technologies quicker than other countries do, embrace them, and put your economic growth path on that trajectory. The spin-off, of course, is all the spin-offs you have for climate change, because they are automatic. But what you've done is you've made yourself a winning economy. And, you know, you need to be visionary about that, but you also need to be pragmatic about it. You need to be visionary to think that that's what we're going to do, those are the technologies. But you have to be pragmatic in the sense that how you're going to get
out the house.
Because it's to try and say, you know, we must be more ambitious and put the curve down, yeah, when you just know it's not going to happen.
But
and then you get the snowball effect, things reach a certain stage, and business automatically then has to move into there, because that is where industry is going, that's where you're going to make money, etc., etc. And of course, some people always still make money from their old technologies and so on, until that's just not there. And that's fine, because the economy needs to run like that as well. So, you know, I think the things you're saying make imminent sense.
You see,
without being a laptop for big business.
But, Chair, you see, I think it comes also to Mr. Morgan's question. Of you can't have a situation where a mitigation, an allocation of carbon space becomes the selection of successful economic sectors. We have seen in the industrial policy at the moment that the government seeks to identify and select winning sectors. It doesn't work. So much less should we be using a completely different approach to try to select winners. We must be saying what is a methodology which allows us, learning from others that have already done it, what is the best way for us to divvy up the space per sector? And we've got to do it to company level. You can't regulate a sector. You can't say to a sector, you must achieve this reduction over 20 years. Because you can't nail the individual.
You can, but then you must break it down.
You've got to do the sector first, then for the law, you must allocate to company. And
you do the cake, the internal space open,
exactly.
The cake.
Exactly.
Then you say this, now it'll go to sectors, and now you go
correct
to company. But even that's going to take time.
It's
I mean, firstly, you're going to go to Sasol, you're going to go to Eskom, you're going to go to the big, the other 4%, the 3% emitters, and that's where you're going to do it. I mean, you're going to get to the small company in Pitsunavata who does leather tanning. You're going to get that in the year 2020. You may get to it.
Exactly.
You know, you're not going to. I think, for me, this thing is very pragmatic.
But you've got to be. The important thing is that you can't, at the first start, at the gate, decide I'm only going to look at these sectors. That the white paper.
You have to look at the economy.
You've got to look at the economy as a whole.
Yeah.
You've got to have everybody in the room. You've got to get a methodology so that you can, in fact, implement over a period. And I think if we could do that, we'd probably be all right. As long as the economic departments are in place, that's why the implementation plan is so important in our view. The implementation plan is a government-wide implementation plan. It cannot be a DEA implementation plan. Because quite often a single department is a custodian, the others don't want to play nice anyway.
No, that's not the plan. They've got a cross-cutting intergovernmental structure, national, provincial,
and so they need to do that. So I think that's important. Chair, if I can come to your gut feeling, informed gut, the line is too low. Given
okay
where we are.
Okay. Now, I think that was good. Thank you very much, Busa. We appreciate we had too much time. Appreciate you. I must say I'm very glad that you have come in public to say these things. Because it's very important that, you know, people see the attitude of business. Because a lot of things are, I mean, look, business does some stupid things. I mean, you heard Cecil the other day. You wouldn't believe that these people have brains. You wouldn't think that they live in South Africa. Because they just can't make stupid statements here. Things like, we never thought that government was creating fixed target. We thought it was all aspirational, and we are dealing with aspirational, you know, stupid things like that. It's just difficult to think that intelligent people come and say that. But what it does do, it then creates the kind of impression that there's just total respect. But I think what you've done today, you've come and given a very balanced view. I mean, there are interests that business have, but importantly, to try and move in that area. And what I wanted to say to you is that, you know, people mustn't see the white paper as the end, it's the beginning.
No, no,
so from next year onwards, we'll be having public hearings for implementation of the white paper. How is it happening? What is happening? All the issues you've raised now, are we going to do it like this? There'll be opportunities to come and say to us where you're thinking things are not moving right, not so on. So, you know, obviously you've made the point that you need to not just have one department, but this committee at least will be having the responsibility to look at the implementation of the white paper. And we'll find ways of doing that in the next years to come. While we, you know, we can't talk when we're not here. Someone else. But I think that what that means is that business and everyone else must keep these structures intact so that you're measuring what's happening and the outcomes and stuff so that we can see if the policy is right, whether adaptions are needed and so on. Okay?
Thank you.
So thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're running very late and already our program is moving towards 3 o'clock. I know people like to not sit here till 3 o'clock. Let's quickly adjourn for anyone who wants to go to a dark, dingy place. Please be back in 5 minutes and then we'll start the last session. Thank you.
That kind of
fascist
in the Just shoot through the presentation here. It's very quite concise. Like I've said, I'm Sori Kiri from Off the Ground Foundation from Alexandra. My presentation goes like this. This National Climate Change Response White Paper, hereafter referred to as White Paper, is much improved over the Green Paper of earlier this year. Notably, the exclusion of nuclear power from the document, the addition of the numerical values for mitigation targets, a carbon budget approach, and a commitment to keep a well below a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. While this is significant improvements, the main areas for further improvement lie in these four areas, which I've just mentioned. In particular, the numerical values of the mitigation targets are not in line, at least in a large part, with either national or international research on what is required to avoid catastrophic climate change and to keep well below 2 degrees Celsius. In effect, while giving a carbon budget for entities within the Republic, the White Paper ignores the fact that South Africa as a whole needs to take on a constrained budget itself in line with the latest scientific wisdom.
I know someone else has also written that some other NGOs, and I have great difficulty understanding what it means. Are you suggesting that somewhere the scientific world has sat down and said, this is South Africa's target? Because that's what this is. I'm not aware of that ever being done. I'm not aware of internationally any agreement that being set out what South Africa's target is. The only target we have is the one we set ourselves. So I'm trying to understand what this means, because people keep saying that scientifically there's a target that South Africa has. There's no such target. There's never been such a target. The science says that this is how much the world's warming up. I think they all agreed that they would like to not see it warm up more than 2%, but no one has ever then sat down and said, what that means is South Africa can only emit so many megatons. No one has said that, so I'm always trying to understand what you guys are trying to say to us when you say this, because there's no such target.
I don't know whether I should answer this one or continue.
No, explain it to us, because else we can't ask you questions, because what does it mean? You've now written it there, it stands there, but it doesn't mean anything. So you must explain to us, else we can't ask you questions.
Well, to be honest with you, also I'm not a scientist, I'm an activist. This is the information that we come across when we meet as civil society forums. Which of importance could well have been discussed at our forums, provided there was a kind of public participation that we kind of requested, even in your our earlier participation in the Green Paper, that we requested that we need public participation on the ground so that we can alleviate some of this kind of assumption that is kind of referred to as it is indicated here. We have these challenges that we identified as civil society, like I said, on the ground, and lack of kind of support and attendance of government stakeholders on the ground, which come to bring this kind of situation on the table now.
You see, my friend, there's no use making statements like this in civil society. It's not correct. I mean, I hear what you're saying. You're saying, this is what people have said in these forums that you attend. And that's exactly what those two people, the one from Greenpeace and the other one, came and said exactly the same. When you ask them, but where is this? They can't tell you. So let's leave it at that. Clearly there's no answer to it. Let's leave it at that, okay?
I hope what I've also indicated as a way of answering this question.
It doesn't help, because if you guys are going to say things which you can't back up, there's no use. Even if we talk as much as we want to, there's nothing, you can't back it up.
I can't back it up, provided I refer back to people who are informing us.
But I'm telling you that nowhere in the world Has there ever been such a scientific study that says specifically South Africa must only emit so much? We as South Africans, Mr. Dr. Zuma went to Copenhagen and he committed us to the 34% and 32%. He committed us. Nowhere in the world has any scientist told us South Africa must emit so much. That's what I'm saying to you guys. You keep saying that it's not going to reach this 2%, but there's nowhere in the world that such a study has been made. It's just a sometime. So it's no use trying to engage on something that you guys can't engage on. So leave it at that. You can go to the next point, the next paragraph.
Thank you. All right. However, before getting... however, before getting into the issues then, Parliament's incredibility short notice of only 8 days is entirely inadequate and hardly allows citizens of this country sufficient time to engage meaningfully with the white paper. Nor, we imagine, does it give Parliament time to debate and consider the white paper to the best of its ability. Furthermore, Parliament under the Bill of Rights, Section 24 of the Constitution, is specifically mandated to ensure that citizens of this country have a clean, safe and healthy environment. This should be the primary rule under which Parliament engages with the white paper. Accordingly, Parliament cannot but overrule, reject, adapt, amend or otherwise alter the white paper if the constitutional rights of the citizens of South Africa are likely to be infringed upon the white paper. A country that is blighted by the consequences of unmitigated global warming will not be a clean, safe and healthy environment for South Africans to live in. Such a situation will be a complete and utter violation of the Constitution and an abject failure of all organs of the state to rule in accordance with its social contract with the body politic. Therefore, Parliament must not only ensure that this white paper achieves South Africa's emissions reductions in line with the best scientific wisdom globally rather than political expediency, but must also ensure that the executive is given the appropriate direction through the white paper to adopt a negotiating position at the UNFCCC to reduce global emissions substantively according to a global carbon budget. Here comes the recommendations. Number one, the white paper should clearly set out both the emissions pathway and the carbon budget for the global temperature rise of 1.5 degrees Celsius and endorse such as the target for global emissions. This will mean, without a doubt, global peak in temperature in 2011 and/or 2012. It may be possible to have a global peak post 2015, but this will require very steep declines afterwards. A global peak post 2015.
I mean, a global peak in that's this year.
Come again?
I mean, do you realize what you're recommending?
Yes.
That we must peak this year, and from next year we must start going down. But there's not even an international agreement, my friend. I don't understand what you're suggesting. How can it peak this year and then go down from next year if we haven't even got an international agreement?
It does not necessarily that we need to wait for international agreement if we really are feeling or observing the impacts of climate.
But you're saying we must have a target of a global peak in temperature in 2011. The only way you can have a serious recommendation like that if there's an agreement. If there's no agreement, how can we tell the world from next year you must start going down? I mean, that's the consequence of your recommendation.
I get your point, but what I'm saying is we need not necessarily to wait for the international agreement, given the catastrophic impacts that we all already are observing on the ground about climate change.
Yeah, but you see, this is a recommendation. The white paper should clearly set out a mission path of 1.5, which we've already got 2. This will mean, without a doubt, a global peak in temperature in 2011 or 2012. All right, move on.
as a point of reference, the white paper should also clearly set out emissions pathway and the carbon budget for a rise of up to 2 degrees Celsius. All right. Parliament should abandon the peak plateau and decline plastic in the white paper as being neither in line with keeping emissions below 20 degrees nor as a just expression of fair share. This should be replaced with a peak and decline trajectory. Parliament should instruct Department of Environment and Agriculture to conduct a scientific and peer-reviewed study on a carbon budget based on just fair share and limiting an increase to 1.5 degrees within 1 year of the adoption of this policy. This should then be the emissions trajectory of the country. Parliament should remove the conditionality on international finance of South Africa's emissions reductions and rather commit the country to unconditional emissions reductions based on scientific evidence. In defining carbon budgets for entities within South Africa, Parliament should put in place an enforcement strategy for non-compliance. While a carbon tax is necessary, Parliament should not allow the electricity generation and liquid fuel sector, in particular Eskom and Sasol, to pass through the carbon tax onto consumers. Revenue from the carbon tax should be a ring fence for mitigation, that is renewable energy, energy efficiency, demand side management, adaptation and protection of the poor. And Parliament should instruct a Treasury in this regard. Neither carbon capture and storage nor carbon trading has been shown to be effective. In the case of carbon capture storage, it is entirely theoretical. Parliament should not endorse either of these two strategies. In conclusion, Parliament should not allow state funds, including from the carbon tax, to be allocated to new nuclear power plants. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tladi. Obviously, this input is very similar to the first two we accepted from Greenpeace and the other lady from, I can't remember. But the points are still there. Any questions, Ms. Totsetsi?
Not a question, but just a comment on paragraph 4, on top here, that the main objective of this white paper is precisely to address what you are saying here. And I think in short, we thank the presenter for making efforts to come and make a contribution. And this will also be considered with all other submissions that you made. We thank you for the effort and think also in future when you get it to the next step, to be part of all this process. Thank you.
Other comments, issues, debates? Mr. Matebe?
Hi, Mr. Chair. That applies to I know you are not a scientist, but we've got some advice of future writing. I think in future when they advise on this issue, we must be able to debate with them, not just take everything that they are saying, because some of these things really, you yourself, you can see that these are totally impossible. These are things that cannot really be done by government. So Parliament must do this. Parliament must. So I'll just add to that. You must debate with these people, not just take everything. Because you seem to be not understanding what you are presenting. It's like you've been given something to go and say this. And when you are being asked a question, you don't know how to respond to that. You can't substitute. So you must have a robust debate before coming to Parliament with your advice.
No, Chairperson, I don't have much to say, but I can say thank you. present. But what I want to advise on is that when you establish a structure that deals with anything in relation to government, if you have got some, if you don't have any information on it, you are allowed to consult with that relevant department and get more information, especially on this issue of climate change. I see you are very much eager to participate in the climate change issues, but you lack information from what we are doing as portfolio committee and the department also. It's very important that you must consult with the department so that they give you more information. Consult with MPs in your areas. There are MPs in the constituency offices who will give you more information about these things. So anyway, wish you a bright future in dealing with this issue of climate change. But get more information and go to the internet and check everything that's related to climate change and consolidate them so that you can speak very well on these matters and relevantly so, because your document doesn't speak to what. In fact, it's criticizing the white paper. It's criticizing our operation. Anyway, we don't want to go further. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've got such smart gadgets, you don't know how to use them. Look, you know, the problem I have is that... Okay, sorry, Ms. Bengu first.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the presenter for the effort to come and present himself on the theory. Firstly, would like to know what their foundation is doing, because we don't have any introduction for what they are doing of the Crown Foundation. And also on the recommendations, recommendations number 3, it says that the Parliament should abandon the peak plateau and decline a trajectory in the white paper. But at the same time, it said it should be replaced with the peak and decline trajectory. If you can clarify on the recommendation.
You see, what my problem is this. If you look at how the international structures are set up, you have a political negotiating structure. That's where countries come and negotiate. And it's been a mess. They're not receiving, they're not making progress and so on as far as I'm concerned. They agree to something. Then you have a group of scientists, the IPCC, I think they call them. They've looked at the best scientists, the science in the world, and they said to us, hey, we grow at this level, we're going to have problems by the year this, we're going to have problems and so on. That's the scientists. Science has said. Now, the politics is trying to say, okay, this is the science. Do we agree with the science? Like our country said, yes, we agree with the science. We're going to base our policies on the science. And with a lot of countries, we at Copenhagen agreed to 2%. We would agree to the 2%. Now, it's your democratic right to come and argue for 1.5. That's fine. There's no problem with that. But the 2% is what's been agreed to by signing. Now, what we want the world to do is to politically say, okay, this is the science said this. We can only have those many carbon emissions. How do we divide that amongst the world? Bearing in mind the developed world has had a chance to develop, we haven't had a chance. So we must now work out a formula. It's not just a question of saying, okay, your country is the second biggest, then you get only the second month. You must have a scientific way of working out. Developing countries have to have a bit more space than they would allow if you divide the cake up. Now, the cake hasn't been divided. So there's no target telling South Africa, you must meet this target, you must meet. There's nothing like that. That's what we're waiting for. So what did we do? Our president at Copenhagen then said, okay, we will agree to this and this. It's our own agreement. We look at the science. We say, okay, we'll agree at this level. What did we do to do that? We took the LTMS. That's the first measurement we had of carbon emissions in this country. We took that, the science did that for us. We took it as a government, said, okay, we use this, and this is our projection. Now, the white paper goes further and says, not only will we give president gave a general commitment to the world, we will now link it to specific targets and so on. And that's the green line we showed people earlier on. That's what the white paper is. So we ourselves, having looked at the science, have agreed that this is where we're going to do it, and we'll cut it off. Be Because we are not waiting anymore for the world to tell us what is our part. Maybe that's going to happen in a few years' time. So that's why I'm saying, and I said the same thing to Greenpeace, and that to come and say these things to us, we can never pursue this. No sane person can pursue this. But what are we going to say to people? Who are we going to say that the peak must be reached by 2011? We're going to speak to ourselves. So that is just under, you must understand why we're trying to, and as I say, we raise the same thing with Greenpeace and that. That it's no use saying these things because there is no target set like that. We've set the targets over there. So you, people can debate and say, well, we don't think those targets, but what they can't say those targets don't meet the science as required. Because science is required, there's no target put to it. It's just a world target that's been given. Okay, so that's just to understand why we're critical of this kind of approach, because it doesn't take us anywhere. So just trying to give you a bit of background, okay? But as Mr. Matebe said, one thing we don't want you guys to do is stop being involved in climate change. You must be involved in climate change. That's vitally important. That's not the message you must get from Parliament, okay? Can you answer some of the questions if you want to, if you want to respond to some of them?
And thanks for the advices that are definitely building me up, not me alone, but even my constituency down there where I come from. The organization, maybe let me start there. What are we, what we are doing, and so forth, what are we involved in? Off the Ground Foundation is the Section 21 company which works with or around environmental issues, human rights issues, as well as general social upliftment projects. In environment issues, we work with generally your food security programs. Your water management programs, your energy and climate change activities, or shall I say programs. We are not funded as we operate. However, we have some voluntary programs that we as and when do with the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development in Gauteng around, for example, the one that I mostly do with them to facilitate or coordinate the school camps at the either Sacred Coast Nature Reserve or at the one at Rotorblad Nature Reserve. Quite often, I shall say, as and when we also work, we do partnership programs with city parks around the greening, water-wise education, trail walks in their nature reserve that they are run up, yes, run by city parks. We also, as some point, did a pilot project that was done in most presidential northern areas, which Alexander is one of those. That was on run facilitated by Green Lux, which was a service provider for GTAT on implementing backyard, household backyard vegetable and fruit tree air planting, just to encourage food security in the neighborhood. We also do the awareness programs like your cleaning campaigns, and I'm trying to capture almost everything that we are doing, just to give a picture of actually. What we are doing there. And
involved a lot of environmental issues.
Come again?
Involved in a lot of environmental
issues now. Let me jump up to human rights issues. Around human rights issues, we as and when do partnership programs with Human Rights Institute of South Africa around youth rights or having activities around the refugees and migrant rights and what have you, and besides Human Rights Institute of South Africa, we also as and when do programs with South African Human Rights Commission. As I'm speaking, last week in Alexander, we had a three-day workshop on human rights, which was sparked by the issue of housing and xenophobia attacks that were happening in Alexandra. So we had an activity around that where GWs and other community leaders are doing that. And then just to conscientize issues of housing and the rise of the migrant people and so forth. And we also, besides that, have activities of celebrating the international days and national days of human rights. That goes also to the same with environmental days on the calendar and so forth. At some point, two years back, from my organization, I was working with the West Eco Schools program, implementing the Eco Schools program in Alexandra, and which sparked much interest to our members in the organization to really be broad-minded around taking the activities or owning the activities of an environment in our area, including the human rights issues as well, just to make sure that targeting the youth in particular and women, that they get involved in such activities and so forth. And also, on the other side, we also participate in a moral regeneration movement, where I'm also sitting at the working committee of the province in Gauteng around moral regeneration, and also implementing one other program, schools program, targeting the youth, which was sparked by the failure rate of the matric, especially last year, and we targeted a number of schools and youth organizations and so forth to really make sure that we rebuild the culture of learning and teaching in our province, but it's a national program, I should say, that is implemented in all provinces, just that like I'm coordinating it from Gauteng province. What more else am I leaving behind on our background? I think for now, yes. Well, I was just saying that I appreciate the advice that when we are doing clean campaigns, we can think twice about the waste, like Mem said, to recycling, and quickly at the back of my mind came the issue of composting, and there's another program that we've just learned about, is WEMARI, which is another one that can be good, and in addressing climate change issues, this can be a mitigation and adaptation program that we really we are looking forward to. And on that score, I will wish that the identification of the climate change officers in the province, in the regions, even in the locality, should be speed up as the chair has recommended earlier on. And maybe we should not even by ourselves wait for that mandate to be done. We can, by ourselves, through the nature of the issues on the ground, encourage the such departments from the province to the local to really help those people, or as and when give them a temporary person to really work with us on these issues, because that's where maybe we can get resources and then we can move much quicker on these issues.
Also within the Department of Environment, there is this campaign of Adopt a River that they are funding. If you can also look at that.
You can adopt your scary river.
The polluted part is
left. Yes, that would be the best one. And I've just got an invitation from extended invitation from one of my colleagues I'm working with from the other side, from the CGW, is that on the 23rd there will be trees planting around Joske as an exercise to address or awareness about the COP17. So like I said, sometimes most of the information does not get down to people on us in time. And it's like some other people have been long informed about this, but now it's only coming to us late yesterday, but it's not a trace mesh. We have to correct some of the challenges that we face in our government, not only in our government, sometimes even in our own secret society organizations. Communication, most of the time, I don't know, people all like to own information, and morally is quite wrong. And that's why we need to really consider in moral regeneration in every element of the issues that we are taking. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Once again, I want to thank, there are not many community organizations or structures in the communities that take the opportunity to come to Parliament. I really appreciate it. It's important that we engage with you. Once again, we do hope you realize that the white paper is a start of a process, it's not the process itself, and that we probably in future will engage more vigorously on climate change than we've done until now, because now we've got a policy we can engage with and measure things against. We didn't have it previously. It didn't exist. So hopefully we'll be seeing more of you sometime in the future.
I will call you to come down to our place when we've got major events to really see if we really are walking the talk.
No, send it to us if we can deploy. I'm actually, for a long time, I wanted to be like the ANC, just deploy people. Attend. So send us the invites, we'll deploy people.
May God bless, we'll do that.
Thank you, thank you.
All right. That submission now it is Fractal, Mr. Ian Perrin. Take a seat, please. The paper is number 12. There's no PowerPoint presentation.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to come here today. It's wonderful to see such an open process and to be able to contribute to it in a small way, and I hope to be able to contribute again in the future. I realize that you're a little bit late and lunch is around somewhere, so I'll try and be concise and not delay over much. I can follow on a little bit from the last submission. We're another environmental group, just think of us in those terms. And we probably get our information from much the same sources as the previous submission. But I'm not here today to make demands to you at all. We're here perhaps to look at a little bit at the science behind climate change. And I was very interested to hear our chairperson describe the process and the link between scientists and governments, and agreed or would have agreed with all of that at the beginning of this year at the time of the Green Paper. Sadly, science has changed its mind a little bit in the last year. And we're beginning to see some mainstream scientists now tell us that the 2 degrees centigrade rise is no longer appropriate, that it's dangerous. And I want to take you through the paper which I've submitted as an extra one with my submission from Drs. Hansen, James Hansen, who is perhaps the most well-known climate scientist in the world. He's been leading that field, I would say, for 25 years, and his opinions have largely proved to be accurate. And here he is in the paper we're looking at today, telling us that, hey, watch out, things are not even as difficult as we already know. They're even more difficult. And I think you're going to see that coming from mainstream science over the next couple of years, ending perhaps with the AR5 document in 2013. Chair, you were describing to business how they were likely to benefit from being ahead of the game in terms of information. And that's where I believe this committee should be. I don't think we can just sit and say, well, the science has not been declared by IPCC yet. I think we need to be aware that the science is moving, that we're learning more and more about what's going on with global warming, and what we're learning is not very good news. Let me turn to the paper itself and try and explain to you in layman's terms a little bit exactly what these two scientists are talking about. They started by taking paleoclimate evidence, going right back. You can see at the top left, that's the beginning of the Cenozoic era, when dinosaurs were around, or at least when they disappeared. And it's slightly odd that those two gentlemen should use paleo data, because they work for NASA. They work for the Goddard Institute of Space Studies in New York State. And they have obviously, around them, have lots of information from NASA. They have the supercomputers that allow them to develop the global climate models that have hitherto been used to make projections of the climate. They also have, obviously, satellite information. They have first-hand knowledge of it, and their careers have been built using those two facets. But now they're looking at the paleoclimate data from ocean cores and from ice cores, mainly in the Antarctic. If you can see those three diagrams, the first one relates to 65.5 million years. They then look at the last half of that, the Pliocene and Pleistocene eras, which are just over 5 million years. And down at the bottom, they look at the recent performance of temperature on planet Earth. I'm sorry, it says update is ready to install, but when it hides a little bit of that, but yeah, please. Thank you very much. So what they did was to try and examine the climate at two points where it was stable, and one of them is right now, or was until recently, the era of the Holocene. That's the era in which mankind developed and which civilization developed. They also took the bottom right, the last glacial maximum, the time when the ice extents were at the greatest, the time when the Earth was coldest. They found a temperature difference between the two of 5 degrees centigrade. And they used that to calculate the forcings that have occurred in the period when the temperature climbed from what you see at the bottom there up to the present day Holocene. It's a complicated process, but it's been done many times, not by these two gentlemen, and they consider the forcings, that is, what's pushing the temperature from one place to another. If you turn an electrical kettle on, you're forcing the water inside from a low-level temperature up to boiling point. So that's what they are required to calculate in order to go further. Excuse me. If you don't mind, I'll use my notes a little bit at this stage. The last 5 million years, you can see, the last 65.5 million years at the top. I'd just like to point out the blue bars at the top right. The uppermost is when the Antarctic ice was forming, and the lower one is when the Arctic ice was forming. And the temperatures on the scale on the left is the deep sea temperatures that they got from those deep sea cores. And you can actually see, even there, that the temperature difference is not between. Let me just stand up and point to that, because this is quite important. That is the temperature at which the Antarctic ice sheets were forming. And it's on that scale is about 4 degrees. So that's not an awful lot above current day temperatures. Sorry, lost my place. And they used the figures first of all with the ice core data, and then also with the deep sea core data, and they find that they get pretty good agreement between the two, but that the ice core data have peaks which they don't see in the deep sea temperatures, and these methods of measuring are very accurate these days. So they wonder what on earth that is. Why do they see a difference in the temperatures over a period of time in the deep sea cores from those that are in the ice cores? And they see these differences, these peaks, at the point where the temperature is rising, or where it's getting near its maximum. And they go on to look at, and if you'll excuse me, I'll just find the page. Maybe you can help me there. Excuse me one moment. Go back in there. Go to scroll there. Several pages. Just a bit more until you see the light. There. Thank you. Now that's fine. Yeah. You can actually see these peaks on the bottom of that chart. They've used, at the top, they've used the CO2 concentration.
5 minutes left.
I beg your
pardon? 5 minutes left.
5 minutes. Okay, yeah. We can do it in
5.
We can do it in 5. The top of those top chart represents the CO2 and methane concentrations. The blue lines in the second one down are third one is the deep sea temperatures overlaid with the blue line from above, and the last one is the ice core temperatures. And you can see on the bottom right that there's those peaks that are different on the in the ice core temperature measurement. So they go on to do their science, and over several pages of their papers you will see this, and calculations of sensitivities. But they come back to this problem with the deep sea ice cores. I'm sorry, the deep sea cores and the ice cores, and what those peaks actually represent. And they find now that the only explanation that they can truly come up with suggests that that is due to rapid ice melting. The ice sheets appear to melt very quickly in this period of time when temperature is changing upward. And when they start to measure when that happens, it was probably within half a degree of where we are now. So they're saying, look out, we may well be in for some serious acceleration in terms of the world temperature at those points in time. And they then go on, and let me just read you the conclusion that they reach. They say that the Earth is poised to experience strong amplifying polar feedbacks in response to modest additional warming. In other words, that's really what I'm trying to say, that if those peaks represent something that's there that may well be beginning to happen now. And the signpost to what is happening now is the recent melt in the sea ice extent in the Arctic. And you may well have seen that in the melt season, which is the northern hemisphere summer, the sea ice extent in the Arctic decreased very nearly to a record minimum. And this, is, they suggest, is the first signs of what we're looking at with those peaks. And they come to the conclusion that really 1 degree centigrade rise in temperature is what we should be looking at, and not 450 parts per million, rather 350 parts per million in terms of CO2. So what I think I want to draw your attention to today is that there are two mainstream scientists that are warning us that the science at the time of AR4 was not as accurate as it is now, that the work suggests that we are in further danger. And that work is also being backed up by other scientists, not just the two of them. There are several well-known, well-reputed scientists who are now looking at this problem and saying, this is real. So I commend to you my submission, and I welcome any questions on the science of global warming.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barrett. I always find these, I'm not a scientist, I'm a lawyer, so I find it interesting when one engages with it. But are there any issues, questions? I think the fact of the matter is our government and our committee are firmly committed to try and move our response to climate change on the basis of mainstream scientific evaluations and predictions, particularly the IPCC. And as I've said previously, we've committed to the no more than 2% increase in line with many other countries at Copenhagen, so that's the basis on which we operate at this stage. But I also have no doubt that if the scientific information were to change down the line, then clearly our response will have to change accordingly. So I can assure you that would be the case. But any comments, any questions, Mr. Morgan?
Chairperson, thank you for the presentation. It's fascinating. I'm firstly very well aware of the science as it relates to the what really we should be aiming for with regards to maximum average temperature increase, and the debates around 1.5 are becoming increasingly well known. It's interesting, of course, to note that the IPCC, the actual negotiating arm, quite clearly said they're only going to revisit this in 2015 from a negotiating point of view, the actual target. So I think there's nothing wrong with the South African negotiators, of course, within the context of the UNFCCC continually looking at that. We are somewhat hamstrung by the entire process as it comes together because, as much as many people want to see that level of ambition increase now, even in Durban, it's probably not going to happen. And I know you'll probably say, well, that puts the climate in peril. I accept that. But I mean, I'm more interested, at the moment, I'm very interested in the South African position. It's useful, of course, for overall science. I'm more interested in your views, however, on the South African response. And particularly with regards to what is acceptable for us to do as a country. Now, the negotiations are very clear on a couple of key principles, including common and differentiated responsibility being the one. The acknowledgement that the vast majority of emissions that have been emitted since the Industrial Revolution have been as a result of industrialized countries. There's also a general acceptance, I agree it could be challenged, view that developing countries deserve a certain amount of carbon space in which to develop. So what I'd like you to do in the context of what you've just presented us is to actually talk specifically to what type of load and trajectory and ambition we as South Africa should take. Because while I accept, let's even talk whether it's 2 or 1.5%, we have a contribution to make. I accept that. There is a moral and ethical issue here as well, in terms of doing what is our fair share. Of course, there's also an issue of doing what is conceivably possible, bearing in mind that our emissions in the country are 1% of the entire globe, and that even if we attain our targets roundabout by 2020, all of those emissions which we save will be released by China within 65 hours, entire savings. So the question I ask you then is, in light of what the science says, could you talk us through your views on how South Africa should respond? Should we respond according to our fair share in terms of the ethical things? Should we say, well, yes, we aspire to get to a certain place, but we need space to grow? Or should it be like some of the submissions which we've had over the last 3 weeks, which say we've reached our peak is now, and we have to stop immediately and decline? So I'm interested in interpreting this into a policy framework so that we can sort of take the debate forward a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? No? That is it, Mr. Perry. Thank you. Can you respond if you want?
Yes, thank you, Gareth. I've seen that there's an interesting proposal coming forward, maybe from the Indian delegation to COP17, that suggests that each country should be responsible for removing from the atmosphere that CO2 that it's emitted and any other greenhouse gas. I don't see that that's going to be universally welcomed and all signed up to by the end of this year at all. There's a certain moral justice in that. As you know, I originate from the UK. The UK is well up there in terms of its responsibility for creating the problem. And I still am a citizen of the UK, I think there's a large body of opinion in the UK that feels that they have to take a lead in this and to do the very much their
quantify any kind of reduction from the CO2?
I think there's also a lot of sympathy for developing countries, for South Africa, and the fact that you can't just suddenly move to clean technology. I was listening earlier to a description that we have to move to a smart grid in order to take full benefits of renewables. I don't have the expertise, but I'll try to get towards that, where I can make a sensible comment about how possible or not that is. And I heard it said, I think, that it wasn't immediately possible. So there are things that as countries outside South Africa would really love to see happen, but my understanding of economics is not sufficient to advise you, certainly. And I would rely much on this committee to do exactly that. We see the moral dilemma. We see what's possible and what may not be possible. And we just want to, we also see the magnitude of the problem. I think it's something that everybody has to cooperate together with in order to even begin to resolve the problem. So I'm not sure that I can fully answer your question at all, but I think we can begin to develop our response to that kind of question.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks. Oh, sorry, you want to follow?
Yeah. Chair, if you may indulge me, Mr. Perenant, you are, given a particular presentation, I think it's very valid input, certainly on what we should be aiming to in the point of sight. But you and I do know, Perenant, Chair, because you are the chairman, I do think it's fair, and I don't think it's fair, I really think you should spend 2 or 3 minutes on one issue that you are particularly passionate about, and that is shale gas. And no one's mentioned anything about shale gas in the terms of the last 3 weeks, and I think you should share with us some views, because you mentioned it in your paper, but you don't reference it, you didn't reference it in your oral presentation. You're the only person given us anything written or oral on the topic. So what are the key things that we should be looking out for with regards to
Yeah. Yes, thank you for pointing out. Yes, exactly. Thank you for pointing out that omission. The science is not solid in terms of whether shale gas is much better than coal as a fuel in when you look at producing electricity from shale gas. There have been 2 papers this year, one of which was presented by 3 professors from Cornell University, the Howard Dow paper, and another paper that looks at even without the assumptions that Howard made, in terms of the emissions of methane during the actual drilling and pipelining of the gas to the power stations, even without that information that Howard used, there's still very little improvement in the value of the amount of greenhouse gas that's produced by replacing coal-generated power stations by natural gas, which is using gas from shale. The process is leaky. Some of the methane, and it depends how much you assume is lost, but certainly something like 1.5% or 2% is the common figure. The oil and gas industries have the best information on this, and we're not sure that they're really giving us the information we need. So independent studies need to be made of what the fugitive gas is, how much of it there is. And there's also a discussion about how bad methane is as a greenhouse gas. the IPCC figures have been making it look a little bit worse every time they report. But they also produce figures for a 20-year period and a 100-year period, and say that methane is very bad if you look at it from a 20-year period, but doesn't look so bad if you look at it from a 100-year period. And of course, if you're an oil and gas man, you take the 100-year figure, which looks better. If you're an environmentalist, you take the 20-year figure, which makes it look worse. And so there's a discussion in science as to what you should really use, you know, what figure you should use for how bad methane is. And I don't think that's anywhere near concluded yet, and may take 3 or 4 or 5 years. And the problem then is, are we going to lock ourselves into a technology, shale gas and the fracking process, that is going to lock us in for 40 years, and maybe to a fuel that we're going to find out in 4 or 5 years' time is a dirty fuel. And I think the argument that comes from what I was trying to put over with the Hansen and Sato paper is that if things really are worse, we mustn't use new fossil fuel sources to generate electricity. But we really do have to push on with renewables. And I think we may be a little lucky there. The technology seems to be improving day by day in terms of the renewables. And the prices are coming down. It's becoming possible. They're saying in the United States, for example, that you'll be able to put solar panels on your roof by 2015, or maybe 2016, where the power from those solar panels will be the same or less than the cost of the power you get from the grid. So that's not a long time scale. We can be looking at situations where there are technological solutions to these problems, and it doesn't seem, therefore, from our point of view, worth the risk of going towards shale gas.
No, I thank you. Anyone want to raise any issues around that? Seems quite straightforward that what is being submitted is that there is uncertainty as to the cleanness of the fuel or not, and that is the objection, as I understand it. And there are other alternatives. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Perrin, for sharing your information. I appreciate always being updated on the latest scientific information available, and I find it useful. I'm sure the committee does as well. So thank you very much. Thanks. All right. Now there's a few that have fallen out. Agri Organics. Who is speaking on behalf of Agri Organics? What is your surname, sir, please?
Klink. K-L-I-N-K.
Okay.
And that is Agro.
You know the drill? 5 to 10 minutes. The submission is, there's a slide presentation, and then the submission number is 34.
Thank you for the long hours you've spent on the white paper. Dear Chair, the team, and all present, I hope my message is clear and your actions to be taken can be substantiated. And I think we are so few people left here that I quickly go through this. We are, I'm a member of the Organic Sector Strategy Implementation Committee, which is trying to get the sector together, and that's the organic sector, trying to get that together, and that has been done by DOF, for the last 10 years sort of trying to get the organic agriculture going, and out of desperateness we said we need to fall under one or other program, and we need to try and bring maybe a flagship program from climate change from climate change response side on the floor, and get maybe your attention and say to Doug, please, we need that. And the reason why we might not, or let me quickly go through, is your paper says we need to identify, and then we need to go to departments and say, this is what you need to do. So that is already in your paper. If you look at how the current agriculture works, and you look at the money trail and the cost of it, then you see the cost of standard prescription is the driving force. So the challenge here is nobody of the current agriculture will say, okay, organic agriculture is an alternative. But if you look from what it can do to the community, what it can do to climate change, then it becomes very, very interesting. And the main reason is that you have a paradigm from a soil fertilized soil to a micro-fed plant. And that is where your carbon will be absorbed. And up goes your production, the plant gets healthier, down gets the crop protection, down gets the fertilization by soil. Again, you have an industry that uses a lot of energy to produce those goods that you can reduce. If you look at what needs to be done, then obviously if your whole meat systems to the support of organic agriculture needs to change. And that's where a lot of people are currently sitting getting money. And they won't say, okay, we need to change and because we have to move out, or we need to, and that is where we say there is room from your side, from the climate change response side, to get a scientific reference group together to bring about and look into what it can do, what is needed to bring about the change. And if that is done and creates enough critical mass, then Duff will say thank you, because we can address a lot of other challenges. And if you look at your paper and you're saying what we need to do, strengthen biodiversity, conserve, prioritize impact assessment, institute effective monitoring, then you actually look at organic agriculture and the way organic agriculture needs to be managed. So you try to manage your climate response change the same way as organic agriculture is managed, by monitoring and really going to it. The strategic plan, I won't go at detail, the time is short. What it can do is if you have the scientific reference group giving scientific guidance, and you replace product that you use by monitoring, then you can move a product-driven agriculture to a systems-driven agriculture. And with the potential, and that is, comes from a 30 years research. The Rode Institute is one of the major research institutes that says if you farm organic, about 8.2 tons per hectare CO2 can be brought into the soils, and that could bring 90% reduction. 90% that you can absorb into the soil. Now that figure, obviously, again, figures are patient. Professor Auerbach is saying 30%. There are other people saying 40%. 90% looks a bit high, but if you look at the research paper, then it is credible. So, South Africa, irrigation about 2.5 million hectare times 8 tons. You can work out what it does mean for the South African. And in the program, that in the flagship program, one would try to get a couple of things together, get a scientific cluster. They do exist. For example, at the University of Free State, they have a cluster. I've spoken to them, but it needs to be initiated by government. We cannot do that. And if we do that, obviously, we return to your paper, we can make a fair contribution that enables...
Thank you.
That enables economic, social, and environmental development to proceed in a sustainable manner. That comes from your paper. So, in brief and short, we missed in your paper the organic flagship program. Thank you.
Thank you. Why will you say organic farming, if it will be introduced, I don't know on what scale, but it will absorb 90% of the world's current greenhouse gas emissions?
And that is a study done by the Rode Institute, which does compare the Green Revolution agriculture with the organic agriculture. And they've established that figure.
But what does it mean? I mean, to use up 90% of greenhouse gas emissions, are they suggesting that the whole world has to be, agriculture has to change to organic?
That is what they suggest. Yes, obviously, if they would change. Just to give you one little experience, if you go into the Philippi farms and you take a cabbage and you pull that cabbage with a little hand scale at about 20 kgs, you pull it out. If you farm differently, if you feed it by microbes, that is what a systems-driven agriculture is, then you can take even an 80 kilogram scale, won't pull it out. So the volume of roots, the volume of life that is underneath the soil is tenfold of what a salt fertilized agriculture gives you. So obviously where does these roots come from? They're made out of carbon. They're made out of carbon. So if you change away from a salt fertilized agriculture to a micro-fed agriculture, a systems-driven agriculture, then the root volumes and the life volumes underneath the soil increases dramatically. If that happens, then obviously your traction is reduced. You don't need these big tractors. You can use very, very small instruments. There's an energy saving that you have. You don't use the salt that is manufactured by the industry. Again, energy savings. So in total, you could come up to about 90%
drawn
into the soil.
Why is the Department of Agriculture not interested in this? I mean, if it's got obvious good things attached to it, according to you, why are you suggesting they're not interested in it?
Chair, I am not the department. I am not the department. We have been the plant production director for the last 2.5 years has, in a way, contributed to bring the organic sector together. But there is no energy. Not at all. There's a fridge study being done, brought out 3 years ago, where they say all the government departments, and they name them, are saying we need to work together. That hasn't happened. So I'm standing here in the chief pole, that is company, sector, strategy,
and you don't know, and you don't know why government is not interested.
Well, I don't know.
You don't know, okay.
Yeah, that's fine, that's all I ask.
Any inputs? Interesting stuff? Obviously, we'll engage with, in the coming year, and so we'll engage with those departments and see what issues there are. Ms. Skozani, anything from you? No? Anything from you, Ms. Darwin? No? No? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Can I just ask... you know, I'm very fed up with the department because they promise that they'll have someone here every day to take notes and so on. The last few days they haven't been. So I would like you to, from the committee, to engage the department, the DG, and say that it's totally and utterly unacceptable. I still want a report of all the days. I don't know where they're going to get the information if they weren't here, but I want a report covering all those days. I can't understand how they can give us a list of who's going to be here and then people just stay away. I really want action taken. This is ridiculous. I think the next thing we must do is you must make sure that every committee, the chairperson of every committee, I know in the beginning you sent the set of submissions to them, but now there's a lot of new ones that have come in. So I want to make sure that you make sure that every committee with an index has every document that was submitted here. Because here today we get something on agriculture. We're not dealing specifically with it, so I want them to have it, so at least they can try and engage on it. Obviously for the committee, it doesn't look like we'll be able to get I haven't tried to even engage for another input on acid mine drainage for next week, because I just think it's a bit early, so I'm going to do it in the new year. So maybe what we'll do next week is probably only meet on one day, just briefly, to sit and just share some ideas around the white paper and the hearings. And I mean, I'm not too sure how much, I don't think this should be something long, because I think my feeling is that most people accept the broad structural changes in the white paper. Obviously, there's a question of how fast and how quick, that's always the issue. And some want it faster, some want it quicker. And for me, it's mainly the issue of the funds and whether there should be legislation or not, are the issues that I think are outstanding, really. But I want us to have at least a little bit of a discussion next week. So I think probably on Wednesday morning next week, we meet 9:30, and then, you know, we'll give each one, particularly parties, a chance to say a bit and so on. We're not going to get a report done by next week, clearly. So if we really need one, we'll probably do it in the next term. I am busy drafting a program for next year. Obviously, the focus will be the two pieces of legislation, and then in the beginning, whatever public hearings you wanted to do, the EIA, the RINOs, and working for projects, try and see how much we can fit in the beginning of the year. Then we'll obviously start doing the budget. And then the follow-up things like AMD, the National Planning Commission has brought out its report. Remember, we said we wanted them back to come and do that. Sometime in the year, we'll have to process where we want to start relooking the beginnings of the implementation. I imagine that should be by the middle of the year, probably June or just after in August, so to give them some time to start doing things. And then the usual stuff, the pricing of water and and then looking at all the entities, the water boards and so on. So I'll try and put together a program like that, at least so we can get venues and stuff. Obviously that'll be a provisional program. We can adapt it as we go along. So next week, Wednesday, we'll sit and chat a bit about the white paper, which will be the last thing we do for the year. And if people want to say a few things about COP and that, I'll give them a chance to say that. I'm not sure. And GLOBE and IPU, which we're attending. We'll do all those things then. Anything else that people want to raise? You happy with that process? ANC happy also? So happy one of the ANC members that's here. One on one. All right, and I know that all the people are not here, but I should say it publicly. Firstly, I thought that the white paper process has been very excellent. I think firstly, whatever complaints there are about process, I take those complaints seriously, but I also sometimes look at it a little bit more circumspectly, because we've been busy with the process for 5 years. For people to suggest after 5 years that we're still in the beginning of a consultation process and everything must be it. But in the end of the day, I take those comments for what they are. Insofar as we have not given much time for this process, we've acknowledged that from the beginning. We accept that there was very little time for comment of this process, and it was simple. There's a white paper which is the policy of government. We felt as a committee that before we go to COP, where we have to play a leadership role, we felt that at least let, even if there's little time, let civil society come and at least say what they want to say on the white paper. So it's not just something we take at COP and there's been nothing said about it. And I think that our decision, even if there was short notice, has been vindicated. Because I felt that we've had some excellent inputs. I, as a committee chair, and I know the committee as a whole, feel much more comfortable in knowing what people's comments were, whether there are really big issues that are problematic or not. There's clearly not such big issues. I think the country as a whole is on quite an even keel as far as this policy is concerned. Obviously, the real work is only starting now. Because if you look at the policy paper, it is basically a policy paper of principles. It's not a policy paper of detail. It's the principle of carbon pricing has been accepted as a principle. Now, as many have pointed out, how do we do it? In a way that we attain our objectives of sustainability and a low carbon growth path, and actually a growth path based on new technology. That's really what it is for me. Whilst we make sure that we don't do damage to our economy unnecessarily as we move along. That there's going to be some pain and so on, I have no doubt, and that pain will have to be taken, but it has to be done in a way that is rational, in a way that clearly we thought through it, and then we make those decisions. I think that's very important. And obviously we as a committee will do our work. I still think that in the new year, we as a committee must push very strongly that there should be a forum of committees in Parliament that deal with the substance of climate change. Not the COP and the procedure of climate change. But how does Parliament pull together committees, say, once a quarter? Those committees are important. And sit down for 2-3 days as a structure dealing with climate change. And go through, let those committees tell us how far their departments are with different projects and programs. I still think we must push that in the new year, that the steering committee that exists there, it can exist, but it looks more at your kind of fluffy issues. I want a committee, or I don't want even a committee, because a committee has certain powers in Parliament. There should be a forum in Parliament where we pull together the different structures, where we can process things on climate change as a Parliament. And I think that I will still think that we must push that, and maybe it's something we should put into our short report on the white paper as well. And then lastly, I wanted to say thank you for all those people that on very short notice and not with much time had a chance to go through the white paper and come and make comments. I'm sure that the comments, sometimes we may have been a bit unfair, where people haven't had a lot of time to look carefully through the consequences of thing and said stuff without having had time to look at the consequences. Maybe in the coming year or so we'll be able to be a bit more fairer to the submissions that are made. So again, thank you to everyone. Thank you to the committee members. I thought we, as a committee, worked well and processed things well, even with all our other tasks at hand. And then next Wednesday we'll have a bit of a chat on the kind of things that we felt were missing in the paper, or where it should be strongly emphasized, etc. Okay? And then we'll try and get a program for the rest of the year, for next year, out as soon as we can. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.